Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
And for the Philadelphia Eagles, the long drought is over. Finally.
What's the latest from Philadelphia? Philadelphia, as predicted, is burning. These people are animals, and they're burning their own city. It's like watching soccer hooligans or watching, you know, Black Lives Matter burn Ferguson. They've trashed a Wawa.
When you trash a Wawa, you've lost
that's
it.
That's bad. I thought they were proud of Wawa. Yeah, I thought it was better than anything we have, Cumberland Farms.
Better than 7-Eleven and Cumberland Farms. But it's definitely not better than Cumberland.
It's definitely not, especially now that they've destroyed them all in the Philadelphia area.
Good point.
They smashed windows at Macy's and other stores because that's what you do when you
win. Pole climbing, fighting. Yes, we've seen it
all. They're pole climbing. They ripped down the awning outside the Ritz.
That's ridiculous.
They like got on top of it and ripped it down.
Yep.
That's just the beginning.
I pray it'll be fun, don't you think?
We're going to have all the details, the number of arrests, the deaths.
Headlines. We'll
this is the Darwin theory.
Did you say deaths?
Deaths,
how many deaths do we have so far? 30, 40?
We're in the triple figures.
Oh, we already? Okay.
But it's not a good thing for the human race. These are mostly
that's a good point.
You know, degenerates and lowlifes who don't
have
jobs.
Have more
jobs.
Respect for somebody who burns down the Wawa than watches This Is Us after the game?
That's close. That's a good point.
Not me. It's not even close.
But there's lots of video out there. We'll be tweeting it out if you want to see the carnage.
And then I got into Memphis, and some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out, or what would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers.
Well, Super Bowl Sunday marked the 50th anniversary of the Drum Major Instinct, a historic sermon that Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. gave at the Ebenezer Baptist Church on February 4th, 1968, 2 months before his assassination. The sermon is mostly remembered for the way King concluded it, by imagining his own funeral, downplaying his famous achievements, and saying, quote, "If you want to say that I was a drum major, say that I was a drum major for justice."
Well, on Sunday, on that 50th anniversary of the speech, Ram Trucks marked the anniversary by using part of it in a Super Bowl ad to sell trucks. The ad featured King's voice played over video showing U.S. Marines, ranchers, and a soldier wearing camouflage.
Want to be important? Wonderful. If you want to be recognized? Wonderful. If you want to be great? Wonderful. But recognize that he who is greatest among you shall be your servant. That's a new definition of greatness. By giving that definition of greatness, it means that everybody can be great. You don't have to know about Plato and Aristotle to serve. You don't have to know the theory of relativity to serve. You don't have to know the second theory of thermodynamics in physics to serve. Generated by love.
Well, in that same speech that Ram used for a truck ad, Dr. Martin Luther King warned the drum major instinct is a desire to be important and seek recognition, which advertisers take advantage of.
The presence of this instinct explains why we are so often taken by advertisers. You know,
are those gentlemen of massive verbal persuasion. And they have a way of saying things to you that kind of gets you in the bind. In order to be a man of distinction, you must drink this whiskey. In order to make your neighbors envious, you must drive this type of car. In order to be lovely to love, you must wear this kind of lipstick or this kind of perfume. And you know, before you know it, you're just buying that stuff. That's the way the advertisers do it. It often causes us to live above our means.
Make it plain.
It's nothing but the drum major instinct. You ever see people buy cars that they can't even begin to buy in terms of their income? You've seen people riding around in Cadillacs and Chryslers who don't earn enough to have a good T Model 4. But it feeds a repressed ego.
So that was Dr. Martin Luther King giving his speech 50 years ago on February 4th, 1968. Well, Juan Gonzalez and I talked to Professor Harry Edwards Monday on the show, and then we did a post-show interview about the appropriation of King's words. Dr. Edwards is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at the University of California, Berkeley, author of several books, including The Revolt of the Black Athlete, reissued last year for its 50th anniversary edition. He was one of the architects of the 1968 Olympic Project for Human Rights, you know, the famous image in 1968 in Mexico City of Tommy Smith and John Carlos with their hands up in the Black Power salute at the Olympics. He's a longtime staff consultant with the San Francisco 49ers. I started by asking Professor Edwards to respond to the Ram Trucks ad using King's words overlaid with images of war.
I work with Dr. King. He endorsed the Olympic Project for Human Rights, and I met with him a couple of times about that movement. When I saw that advertisement last night, I was appalled. I think that to reduce Dr. King's message, especially in this climate, in this country, in under the circumstances that exist now, in terms of not just African-American, but immigrant women's circumstances and so forth, to reduce Dr. King's message to a ploy to peddle trucks, I think is appalling. I think that to pimp Dr. King's message in that regard, in this day and age, under the circumstances that exist, given what we're up against as a people and where we look like we might be headed as a nation, is absolutely despicable. But as appalled as I am about the advertisers' use of it, I'm even more appalled that about the fact that somebody had to sign off on it. They didn't just go into a record store or go online and pick up Dr. King's speech and put it the voiceover on that advertisement without somebody associated with the King Estate signing off on it. And I think that it's just appalling that Dr. King, his words, his wisdom, his critically important message at this time would be allowed to be pimped in that fashion in order to peddle goods.
Well, you know, Harry Edwards, I had the same feeling when I saw the ad, because it's well known that the King family, Dr. King's children, are very protective of the use of his image and of his legacy. And interestingly, I heard on the radio this morning, one of the commercial radio stations, a member of the King family seeking to defend that ad and saying that it was really in the spirit of Dr. King's legacy. And but it seemed to me, as you say, very crass to take a social justice leader and turn him into a, basically a pitchman for cars.
Well, it's not just that he was turned into a pitchman. It's that at a time when we should be studying Dr. King's message and studying his words in this critically important historical era, when we're on the verge of massive changes in virtually every institutional arena, to have watered down any aspect of his message to the point that it becomes an advertising ploy, I think degrades both the wisdom of the message and the urgency what Dr. King referred to as the fierce urgency of now at one time. I think it waters down all of that. And to sign off on something like that, I think is despicable. They are people who are in control of his estate. They most certainly can do whatever they want to do. But in doing it, I think that they should also have to face the judgment of those people in society who regard Dr. King's words and wisdom as critically important and substantially enduring in terms of the struggles and so forth that we face as a society and as a nation.
That's Harry Edwards, professor emeritus of sociology at the University of California, Berkeley, author of a number of books, including The Revolt of the Black Athlete, reissued for its 50th anniversary edition.
I always thought, why didn't I ever have a hero, a black hero? And I always wanted to go to movies and see a black hero. I figured out maybe someday on television they'll have it, man. Like you see on television, they'll come out. Look up in the sky. It's a crow. It's a bat. No, it's Super Nigger. Yes, friend, Super Nigger. Able to leap tall buildings with a single bound. Faster than a bowl of chitlins. We find Super Nigger with his X-ray vision that enables him to see through everything except Whitey.
You're telling me that the king of a third world country runs around in a bulletproof catsuit?
My king.
Stop it.
The Black Panther lives.
A war is coming.
That damn car.
Watch me do my.
I hope you're ready, bro.
Because I'm just getting started.
Let's have some fun.
The King Arrives. That is the tagline to Black Panther, the latest and greatest Marvel comic book superhero movie. But this is one blockbuster with the potential to do more than break box office records. Black Panther, to many, is breaking new ground. And boy, are moviegoers excited. Listen to the kids at this Atlanta middle school after their teacher told them they were going to see it. That unbridled excitement has translated into ticket sales. Black Panther has already outsold all other superhero films in pre-sale tickets ahead of its release next week. If you already have your tickets, then you know Black Panther is the story of a technologically advanced African nation and its powerful, brilliant leader who wears a super cool suit. It features an all-black cast with music by Kendrick Lamar and The Weeknd. And while it may arrive with the usual commercial tie-ins, many feel Black Panther is tied into an important cultural moment as Hollywood's way of saying that Black lives matter. I have three guests joining me to discuss this. David F. Walker is a comic book writer. He has penned Marvel's Luke Cage and Occupied Avengers, among other titles. He is a widely recognized expert on African-American cinema and the author of Becoming Black: Personal Ramblings on Racial Identification, Racism, and Popular Culture. David F. Walker joins us from Portland, Oregon. Adelifu Nama is a professor of African American Studies at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. He's also the author of Super Black: American Pop Culture and Black Superheroes. He joins us from Los Angeles. And Eliza Anyangwe is a London-based freelance writer and editor and the founder of Nzinga Effect, which seeks to promote the stories of African women and women of African descent. We've reached her in a cafe in Paris. Hello and welcome to you all.
Greetings. Thanks for having us.
Hello.
Adelifu Nama, I want to start with you. What do you make of that excitement, even jubilation, that is building as this film is about to hit the theaters?
Well, I think there's some multiple points. I mean, one, let's give credit to the trailer.
I think whoever cut that trailer put together, and they put out a powerful image and a compelling music that if people are going to do their next round of trailers, they need to talk to the people who did this one. The other dynamic, I would argue, if we get right into kind of the racial implications of the film, is that we've had about 41 years of science fiction as a film genre that has dominated the imagination of the American audience and possibly even the world, starting with Star Wars, right? And this particular film, I would argue, is not the Black Panther comic book reader coming to the Metroplex, but I would argue that it is, in its representation, like the first Black science fiction film. And I think it has a certain type of resonance as in terms of 40 years, 50 years of a genre that has primarily excluded Black folk from the technological, the super science, the fantasy scape of phenomenal achievement. And now we get to see this packaged in such a powerful and compelling way that it's capturing the imaginations of young Black folk in particular, who want to live in this moment and see in this moment something that represents what they think they are and probably will be or could be in the near future or far off future.
Eliza Ann Yangwe, how do you interpret the fervor over this film?
Thank you. And again, apologies for the noise in the background. I'm excited as a reader and a fan of comic books, particularly a fan of the Marvel Universe. And, you know, there is a sense that we finally have a film that does the justice to the fact that Black people, African people specifically, and I think that distinction is important, to talk about African people living in the imagination, African people living in a technologically advanced future, African people being the smartest in the world, and where the dominant narrative is of one of death, destruction, disease. Here is a film that says this is exactly the opposite. And so it has captured the imagination of people from that continent and descendants of that continent who have known within them that they are part of a greater narrative, but have failed to see that narrative represented in the popular culture and in the media that they consume.
David F. Walker, to what extent do you share that excitement over Black Panther?
Oh, I have incredible excitement. I'm a nerd at heart. With young people especially, we'll say, just for the sake of argument, under the age of 20 here in America, these are young people that were raised with Barack Obama as president, right? And have known, to a large extent, nothing other than a Black president of the United States. And now we're stuck with what we're stuck with. And I think for young people, part of this excitement is that for the last year or plus, what we started seeing with the Black Lives Matter movement and all the police brutality, we saw so much victimization. We saw so much hate. We saw so much racism rearing its ugly head. Not that it had ever gone away. It was just sort of hiding. But now it's back out there. And I think part of this is and this goes back the history of film. Whenever there are films with large Black casts and marketed towards a Black audience, part of it was the fulfillment of escape fantasies, whether it was the fantasy, the need for justice, the need for revenge, that sort of thing. And I think that's part of this excitement is there's a generation who had a lot of hope for 8 years, and that hope has sort of been is in question now. And film is providing something for them that real life can't provide. And I think more importantly, what film does as the sort of modern equivalent to ancient myth, it allows us as Black folks, whether we're direct African descendants or African Americans or African Canadians or African wherever, it gives us a sense of place in the larger human community, which unfortunately is denied to us most of the time. Our humanity is denied to us in a lot of pop culture.
Adelifu Nama, I know you make the point that it goes well beyond the comic book to sci-fi, but briefly for our listeners who are not comic readers, who is Black Panther? How popular is the comic?
Well, I think in some regards, to capture the popularity of the comic is to almost box yourself in to some type of tangible notion of its impact. I would argue that the popularity of the comic is more measured by its popularity in terms of the black imagination. That the comic book in and of itself has a very limited run. I mean, it starts in 66 with T'Challa challenging the Fantastic Four to a battle of sorts, and so that he can test out his new powers so that he can face Claw, one of his historical villains, and be successful. So he starts off as an anti-hero, and then he gets a limited run in the early 1970s. Becomes just kind of like a sidekick member of the Avengers here and there, gets another run in the late 70s. But the Christopher Priest, as well as Reginald Hudlin, reboots of Panther are the primary source material for the film. And I can say that because I was able to view the film in a screening. So I've seen the Black Panther. And I'll just get right to the point. I really enjoyed the film. I give it a 9 out of 10. I guess I have an unfair advantage in one sense. But
as long as you give us, I was going to say, no spoilers, but then you're free to say whatever you like, but no spoilers.
Right, no spoilers. And so that comic book run in terms of who T'Challa is, and the being receptive to it, like most comic books, they have a kind of like a very small readership, and but dedicated readership.
Eliza, you describe the movie as Afro-futuristic gold. Tell me more about how you see it.
Well, what I meant by that was the presence of, and I'm not an expert in Afro-futurism, but I've seen this growing trend of conferences and events focusing on Afrofuturism. It's this idea of conceiving of a future from an African perspective. And so when I talked about Black Panther being Afrofuturistic gold, I was just musing at the interplay of different things. So there's obviously the technological element, which you find in a lot of science fiction and in a lot of futurism, the role of technology in the future. Then there is this element of the interplay of nature, and it struck me that as part of the ways in which T'Challa becomes Black Panther and gets his strength, he has to eat this herb. And then I think what really clenched it for me was reading about and learning about the fact that his strength comes from the knowledge of his ancestors. And I was born in Cameroon in West Africa, and very much across the African continent, and you see it also with a lot of diaspora communities, is the role and importance of the ancestors. And while I don't read very much science fiction, I didn't know if that connection with technology, the spiritual, nature, and this notion of ancestors featured in those other realms as well. And so those were the things that seemed to me to situate the story very much in an Afrofuturistic context.
Hmm. David F. Walker, how do you think this movie compares to or will compare to past Hollywood representations of African Americans as well as Africans?
That, of course, that will remain to be seen. I haven't seen the movie yet, but I think that it's definitely going to, if I was a betting man, I would say that it's going to give us a representation in many ways, the likes of which we've never seen before.
Good bet.
What's that?
That was a very good bet.
He's affirming your expectations.
And I think that what we're going to see, Black Panther was produced by Marvel and Disney, and I'm not saying this in any sort of disparaging way. Like, Disney has a lock on what the world wants. They understand it. They're experts, and they've learned a lot. They've made mistakes along the way, for sure. But they don't go into tentpole films like this with half-baked notions, and they're really in the business of selling dreams and fantasies to people all over the world. And this is a dream and fantasy that, that for myself, I've had ever since I was a kid. Working at Marvel, working for Marvel, you know, I've been writing Luke Cage. Luke Cage was a hit show on Netflix. There was a moment, when I saw the first episode of Luke Cage, I remember thinking, when I was a kid, I never thought this was going to be possible. Okay, I never thought I would see this. When I saw the first, Black Panther first showed up in Captain America: Civil War, there was this moment that, you know, even as a man in his mid-40s, I reverted back to being probably, I'm not even 12 years old, probably like 7 or 8 years old, because there's an age when you're a black person growing up in America, and I'm assuming the rest of the world, and you're consuming pop culture, there comes a point where you become profoundly aware of the absence of people that look like you. They don't even necessarily have to act like you or be like anybody you know, but it's just the fact that there's nobody there. For me, it meant I did not have a place in these epic worlds. And it also made me think, well, can I get a job creating these things? Because if there's a black person making these movies, they'd at least get somebody in there, right? I meet with young people all the time, and I try to tell them that no one can stop us from dreaming, and no one can stop us from activating our dreams and turning our dreams into some semblance of reality. Even if that reality is a fantasy or sci-fi film, we can do that. And I'm hoping that that's what this movie will do.
Need I remind you that you got no respect for human life in South Carolina? Said.
Black Bike Week is an annual event held in Myrtle Beach where motorcycle enthusiasts gather to celebrate their hobby, show off their bikes, and, yeah, party. And it's held on Memorial Day weekend, just after another big biker convention, Harley Week. That one is mostly white. And as you might guess, Black Bike Week is largely an African-American event. Biker and filmmaker Ricky Kelly attends both and noticed a big difference in the way Myrtle Beach receives the two groups. And what he discovered became the subject of his documentary, Black Beach, White Beach, A Tale of Two Beaches.
White person performs in a certain way as a young man is considered indiscretions of youth. You let the same black man get on a motorcycle, do the same things, and it's considered thuggish behavior.
Filmmaker Ricky Kelly joins me now. Ricky, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
So tell us about what led you to create this documentary.
Well, just years of going and seeing the disparity in treatment warranted me going. It was one particular incident I can recall. I'm standing in front of my hotel, and these two officers rolled up on me and told me to get off the sidewalk. Now, I just paid $220 a night, and I was standing on the hotel's property, not on the street sidewalk. And, you know, I said, I'm not on the sidewalk. And he said, do you want to go to jail? And that alone, I felt so powerless. I felt that, you know, that and several other things, just the over-policing, made me decide to tell the story.
So tell us the story now about Black Bike Week itself. It's a big event. A lot of people show up, right?
Right.
Describe it for me.
Well, on a good year, we can have upwards of 500,000 people if the weather's good. On average, I'd say 350,000 people attend, and it started out with 200 people, so it's just increased phenomenally over the last few years. But it's a great event. It's a lot of camaraderie. Bikers get together and ride and see each other. They haven't seen each other since the year before. It's a good event, but again, I think it's over-policed.
Well, we'll talk about the event that precedes it a week earlier. There's something, and that's become something of a tradition, called Harley Week. You've been to that, too. Tell us about that one.
Well, Harley Week is a little more open. I mean, it's a smaller event, but they have more freedom to do whatever they want. Now it's kind of moved down to Murrells Inlet. There was an incident that happened, Myrtle Beach tried to implement a helmet law in 2008, and a lot of the Harley riders left Myrtle Beach and went down to Murrells Inlet, which is 10, 15 minutes down the road.
But the event, so you're talking about, say, 300,000 for Black Bike Week and about 30,000. So Harley Week is a much smaller event.
Right.
A lot more police presence when it comes to Black Bike Week, but it's a bigger event, right?
Right.
So, but there was a particular event that precipitated this, and it became actually national news because there was a shooting at Black Bike Week of several years ago, and that precipitated an outcry from public officials, right?
Right.
Tell us more about that.
In 2014, three people were unfortunately killed on the Strip, and it gave the whole event a bad reputation. What happened was some young people that was from areas around Myrtle Beach that had been beefing or having words on Facebook. And when they came together at the event, of course, this unfortunate incident happened. And the city officials took that, and the governor at the time, Governor Haley, they took that as the opportunity to really clamp down on our event. A lot of people don't know that Myrtle Beach is ranked number 13th in crime in the nation as far as per capita. And what they're using their crime statistics to justify, you know, clamping down on Black Bike Week, like we're the real problem. But they have a problem with crime year round in this small community.
Not something that then Governor Nikki Haley noted when she called after there were three people who were killed in this particular event, but as you say, not directly associated with the event itself.
These exactly.
are some local folks who happened to be involved. They got killed, and here's what then Governor Nikki Haley had to say.
What we saw happen this weekend does not exemplify what South Carolina is, and I would strongly say, and will continue to strongly say, there are no revenues worth the bad press that we got this past weekend. There are no revenues worth the lack of companies that will come to this area because of what happened this weekend. There are no revenues worth the lack of tourism that we will lose because of what happened this past weekend. It is time for that Bike Fest to come to an end, and that is the way that I'm going to talk to the elected officials of Atlantic Beach, and I think it's time that everybody in Orange County come together and say, no more.
Former Governor, South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, threatening to shut down Black Bike Week. Our guest is Ricky Kelly. He's a biker and filmmaker behind Black Beach, White Beach, A Tale of Two Beaches. You actually compared the crime statistics between the two events now, the Harley Week, which is a predominantly white event, in which we have 10 times fewer people. But the crime statistics were certainly not up by a factor of 10 at Black Bike Week. Much smaller.
Right. Right. And again, they use that event, that unfortunate murder on the Strip to really clamp down on us. They bring in 700 officers. Excuse me. They bring in 500 on top of the 270 that they have to police the event. And it's just you can't go 50 yards without a police officer. And they blocked off the street. It's one lane traffic, and they implemented a 23-mile traffic pattern, which is, in my estimation, unconstitutional, you know. But
it's a loop, right? So you can't get off of it. It's a 23-mile loop, and once you're on it, you can't go down the side streets. You can't go anywhere but around.
Right, exactly. Once you get trapped in it, unless you can prove that you live on this street or that you're staying in this hotel, they would not let you out that loop. And it takes 4 hours to go 23 miles at this pace. And motorcycles are built for air induction to keep them cool. So it's a lot of pushing the motorcycles for miles at a time, really. And it's just a terrible situation. Of course, they only implement that during Black Bike Week.
It's the only week that they do that. And restaurants as well. So other businesses are changed dramatically between the two events and compared to other events throughout the year, right?
Right. They tend to roll out the carpet for the city, and the businesses tend to roll out the carpet for the Harley Week. And then when we come, they pull that same carpet up, and some businesses close down, and they just say it's not worth their business, or they don't want our business. But at the root of it all, I think personally, it's there's a level of racism. This is South Carolina. And it's unfortunate in 2018 or 2017 that we still have to go through some of these things, because there was one restaurant in particular that was sued by the NAACP. They closed their doors, their front doors, and opened up their drive-thru for black business. And it's basically looks like in the 70s, or excuse me, in the 60s and the 50s, when blacks had to go to the back of the restaurant and eat, and we had to stand outside and eat. And then their menu, they only sold barbecue, which at any other time of the year, they sell hot dogs, hamburgers, and ice cream. But just for us, it was barbecue.
Other restaurants that only used plastic dinnerware and were taking things off their tables and that sort of thing. So talk about, and as you say, there have been a couple of lawsuits already when it came to the businesses. Also, some of the signage, you point this out in your documentary, whereas in Harley Week, it's welcome bikers. Black Bike Week, it's no helmets, no hoodies. Those signs go up. So it's a very different feel.
Right. Yeah, it's unfortunate.
Other events around the country, too. You talk to one woman who's a biker. She has been to other events around the country, including at Daytona, and she compared the reception for black bikers in Daytona with the one she got in Myrtle Beach.
I just really enjoy the atmosphere in Daytona much more than Myrtle Beach, in that wherever you are in Daytona, it's welcome. You're welcome as a biker. You're not looked upon or frowned upon, and it gives you the opportunity to ride a lot more. If the police officers are looking at you, they're telling you, nice bike. Wow, can't believe a woman is riding that bike. But in Myrtle Beach, it's more of, let me make sure your bike is registered. Let me make sure you have the proper insurance. Let me make sure you can even afford to ride the bike.
Now, that's Patrice, a biker with the Vicious Riders MC, one of the many who are featured in the documentary Black Beach, White Beach, A Tale of Two Beaches. And I'm here with filmmaker Ricky Kelly. So tell us more about police interactions, too. I mean, 300,000 people who descend on one beach town, that's a lot of people, and it would seem to me would require some extra policing. But tell us about the perceptions that you have about the policing.
Well, certainly, yeah. I understand an uptick in police, but this is overwhelming in some aspects. She was talking about, and that's Miss Foxy, who you just heard. She was speaking about Daytona. I spoke with some of the police officials down there, and they do policing in a different way. They would take four officers and have them walk, you know, the block. And they may have 150, 200 officers staged, you know, two blocks away. So if anything jumps off, they can respond immediately to the situation. But it's not that overwhelming presence of police.
About the interactions that you have or other African-American bikers might have with police?
Well, like she stated, I think, and it comes from when they bring a lot of outside, again, they bring in 500 officers from outside that jurisdiction. And some of these officers come from small jurisdictions where they may have 200 black people in their town, you know, and they've never dealt with 350,000 black people at one time, and it's overwhelming. And you can't just ask them, hey, where is a coffee shop, because they're not from there. And they don't seem to have that officer-friendly attitude when you come. It's like they treat us like we are a horde of gangsters that come into the city. And it's unfortunate, because a lot of those people, the majority of those people, are just hardworking motorcycle owners that want to come down and let their hair down for a week and enjoy it. Because, again, I love Myrtle Beach. I just don't think Myrtle Beach loves me.
You know, I've always wanted to be a cop, with a uniform fit well common to seems. Peeing their niggas, call the greens, and they discuss the politics of dreams. That's why I've always wanted to be a cop, so I can criminalize the gate in your stroll, the shade in your mold, and take a toll. A displaced dark face, as safe as an ace in a hole for a cop. As good as I, a book of guy, drinking crooked eye. Don't resist a pudding pie, you think I won't, but why wouldn't I? I'm a cop.
In Baltimore today, closing arguments in a federal corruption trial involving the city's police department. At the center of it, the Elite Gun Trace Task Force, a unit that once racked up praise for racking up arrests and recovering hundreds of illegal guns. As it turned out, members of the unit were committing crimes of their own, even as they policed Baltimore streets. Eight officers have been charged. Six pleaded guilty. The other two are the defendants in this case. Justin Fenton has been in the courtroom for the Baltimore Sun, and I asked him what exactly the officers are accused of doing.
It ranged from illegal tactics used to stop and search people on the streets to high-stakes robberies where they would identify big-time drug dealers, put illegal GPS trackers on their cars, and break into their homes and steal money.
And how have their lawyers been playing it, the two who are fighting these charges?
One of the officers' defense attorneys has made the argument that his client did, in fact, steal money, but that officers are are empowered to seize money if they believe that there's probable cause, that it's, you know, fruits of a crime. The other officers, attorneys, have generally been chipping away at the credibility of the government witnesses, saying that they're either drug dealers or officers who pleaded guilty and have an incentive to lie.
Does it undermine the case of these two officers who are fighting the charges that some of the witnesses testifying are their former officers from this unit who have pleaded guilty?
You know, I think the officers who took the stand, they outlined a wide range of crimes. They are technically charged with incidents going back to the 2014-2015 timeframe and continuing up through their arrests. But they've also told the FBI and testified that they were committing crimes going back to 2008. And it's really raised a lot of questions about the department's ability to police its own. Oftentimes, these officers were in the crosshairs of internal affairs, but returned to the streets and essentially got promoted into this elite unit.
The backdrop to all of this is the Baltimore Police Department has had problems for some time. I mean, just last month, the mayor fired the police commissioner and appointed a new one. This will be Baltimore's third commissioner in 5 years. So put this in context for us. Do people in Baltimore see this as a band of officers gone rogue, or do they see this as emblematic of a wider, broken police force?
Yeah, I think one of the challenges here is that these officers have demonstrated that with great ease, they were able to deceive judges, they were able to deceive juries, they were able to deceive internal affairs. It doesn't mean that every officer on the force is lying. It doesn't mean they're committing misconduct, but it shows that it's hard to tell who is. This also comes in the wake of the Freddie Gray case, Freddie Gray, who died in police custody. There was riots here. The city at that point pledged that they were going to turn things around and reform the agency. And for this to happen in the wake of that, I think there's a real crisis of confidence right now in the police department.
And what about morale inside the police department? I was interested and saddened to read that last year Baltimore had the highest per capita murder rate in its history. The police had plenty to do, and now comes this corruption scandal and trial. What's the mood like inside the department?
I mean, officers that I know are saying that they can't believe this kind of stuff went on. They say that in their wildest dreams, they wouldn't think that someone was carrying out robberies and home break-ins and all these different crazy things that have come out in testimony. At the same time, one of the arguments the defense is making is that post-Freddie Gray, with surging violence, it opened the door for this kind of stuff, that the agency was eager to get officers who were willing to go out there, get guns, work hard, work long hours, that there was a morale crisis, and that officers like these seemingly stepped up into the void. So now the agency is trying to figure out how do we rein this in.
Justin, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
That's Justin Fenton of the Baltimore Sun. He's covering closing arguments today in a corruption trial involving the Baltimore police.
You want a little tote? Huh?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
Curtis, what is that?
Oh, come on, Derry.
Weed is for niggers. Put that away right now. A little self-respect.
5 years after Washington State legalized marijuana, Seattle city leaders have now decided to erase misdemeanor pot convictions from the past. Charges will be dropped. Convictions will be vacated. It's expected to affect between 500 and 600 people. Allison Holcomb heads up strategy for the ACLU of Washington, and she was the architect of Initiative 502, the measure that legalized marijuana back in 2012. She says today's action is another big step in the right direction.
I think that when Washington voters passed Initiative 502 back in 2012, it really was a statement that they recognized that treating marijuana use as a crime was not only not working for the purposes it was originally intended, but it was also creating a lot of collateral damage, and especially when it came to disproportionate enforcement against people of color in our state.
Now, this new policy announced this morning by the city, it doesn't just drop charges, it also vacates convictions. Can you tell us what that means exactly, and what impact do you think that's going to have on people?
What this change does is it goes back in time to a period when possession of marijuana was still a crime. And it says that people that were convicted under the law at that time will no longer suffer the ongoing collateral damage of having a misdemeanor conviction on their record.
So it's going to be completely wiped clean.
That's right. And I think that that's especially important in the context of marijuana possession, because it's one area in the criminal justice system where we have stark examples of racially disparate enforcement of the law. And I say that because in Washington state, it's always been the case that white people tend to use marijuana at slightly higher rates than their neighbors of color, and yet we see disproportionately that Black Washingtonians are arrested, charged, and convicted for marijuana offenses at three times the rate of their white neighbors.
Can you give us a few specific examples of what this is going to change for people in their lives once this happens?
When you go in to apply for a job, you may have to fill out an application that asks whether or not you've ever been convicted of a crime. You may be asked that in an interview. When you go to apply for an apartment, you may be asked the same questions. If you apply for federal financial aid to go to college, you're going to have to reveal whether or not you've ever been charged and convicted of a crime. And you can be denied access to jobs, housing, schooling on the basis of having a conviction for an activity the Washington state voters have subsequently said, yeah, that never should have been a crime in the first place.
Allison, I'm sure you heard last week the district attorney in San Francisco said that his office was not only going to dismiss thousands of misdemeanor pot charges, but they were also going to think about reducing felony charges, close to 5,000 of them. What do you think of that path? Do you think Seattle should go further than just looking at the misdemeanors?
I think that the challenge is that Seattle doesn't have jurisdiction over felony offenses. We'd need to talk to Dan Satterberg, our King County prosecutor, about what we could do with respect to felony charges. But from a policy perspective, if we're talking about people that have been charged for growing their own marijuana in the privacy of their home, for example, for their own personal use, we are actually the only state out of all of those that have legalized marijuana that still treats that act as a crime. I think we really ought to take a hard look at whether it's right to continue to saddle those people with felony convictions.
Allison, some people listening to us today may be thinking, you know, you were convicted before when marijuana, possession of it was still illegal. Those were the consequences you faced at that time. How would you respond to that?
Well, I think one of the great things about living in our democracy is that we have the opportunity to realize when we've made mistakes and to correct course. We once had Jim Crow laws that segregated us from the same facilities, and we recognized that that wasn't right, and we changed it. And in the case of alcohol prohibition, we amended the United States Constitution and then turned around and repealed it 13 years later. I think that this is a moment in time where we're starting to recognize we've done a good thing, we're moving in the right direction, but we still need to clean up some of the damage that we caused when the laws were different.
That's Allison Holcomb, the Director of Strategy for the ACLU of Washington. Mayor Jenny Durkan says she would support extending this plan to felony convictions, but the city of Seattle would have to coordinate with the King County prosecutor as well as state officials to make that happen.
And I think that is a crime, and they did it. I know they did it because it's a black city. It's a poor city. They wouldn't do this to Bloomfield Hills or Ann Arbor or Grosse Pointe. This was a hate crime. It was a hate crime based on this race hatred of this particular party.
There have been environmental disasters in white cities. Love Canal was not black.
Yeah, but who really, once they discover Love Canal, that they've got a problem, everybody starts to work on it to try and fix it. Not in Flint. They went another 9 months hoping nobody paid any attention because, oh, these are just a bunch of black people, black people.
Scientists announced today that they have figured out the cause of an outbreak of Legionnaire's disease in Flint, Michigan, a few years ago. 12 people died. This was at the start of the city's water crisis. And the problem was a lack of chlorine. NPR's Rebecca Hersher reports.
In April 2014, Flint, Michigan switched its water source from Lake Huron to the Flint River. Almost immediately, residents noticed tap water was discolored and acrid-smelling. By 2015, scientists discovered the water was contaminated with lead and other heavy metals. And at the same time, another health crisis was brewing. Dozens of people were getting sick with something called Legionnaire's disease.
It is caused by a bacterium, Legionella pneumophila, that normally grows in water.
Michelle Swanson has studied Legionnaire's for 25 years at the University of Michigan.
If you don't have a robust immune system, the microbe can really cause a lethal pneumonia.
Usually, Legionnaires is pretty rare, less than a dozen cases each year in the Flint area. But in 2014 and 2015, there was a huge spike, at least 87 cases and 12 deaths. But it was unclear exactly how the water crisis was connected to the outbreak. Earlier studies suggested the chlorine used to treat the water might have something to do with it. Swanson and her team analyzed detailed data and found, yes, the chlorine level had dropped significantly during the crisis, allowing the Legionella bacteria to thrive. The results were published today in two papers. And it turns out there was a surprising link between the high levels of lead in the water and low levels of chlorine. Lead and other heavy metals can soak up chlorine. So when the water company in Flint switched to the contaminated source, they would have had to dramatically raise chlorine levels to prevent Legionnaires.
During the Flint water crisis, the amount of chlorine that needed to be present to reduce the risk of disease was much higher than normal.
That also helps explain why the disease outbreak ended when the city switched back to its original water source, even though the Legionella bacteria aren't completely gone from the water system.
This sort of research is just essential.
Mark Edwards at Virginia Tech was one of the first scientists to sound the alarm about contaminated water in Flint. He says the new findings may lead utilities to take more responsibility for preventing future outbreaks.
Clearly, the Flint water crisis and the deadly Legionnaires disease outbreak showed that there is a role for the water company to protect consumers.
Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
Seattle's a great place to visit because it has, I guess you could say, a little bit of everything, but I like to think of it as a lot of everything.
Hate crime is still in a coma at Harborview Medical Center tonight, 2 weeks after he was attacked.
This and that my son will possibly be in here 3 to 6 months.
Tonight, people gathered at the hospital in support for the victim's family and to say racism will not be tolerated.
Thanks for joining us. I'm David Solano.
And I'm Lindsay Shelton. Cairo 7's Didi Sun has been following this case and joins us live now. And Didi, some powerful words at the vigil tonight.
Lindsay, David, 26-year-old Deshaun Horn is still in the hospital. He is recovering. His family told me tonight that he is no longer in the ICU, but because he is still in that coma, he is still at Harborview tonight. A crowd braved the cold and the rain. They prayed for Deshaun's recovery and said their voices on this issue will not be silenced.
Say his name!
Deshaun Horn!
People hugged each other outside Harborview Medical Center, lighting candles.
We join with the family of Deshaun Horn to remind the world that his life matters.
It's the two-week anniversary of a brutal hate crime in Auburn. Prosecutors say 26-year-old Deshaun Horn was attacked and beaten over the head with a baseball bat while the suspect shouted racial expletives. Court documents say the suspect admitted to police he struck Horn because Horn spent the night with his sister.
Black families are tired of visiting hospitals or preparing for funerals.
Organizers say another purpose of the vigil, to make sure people don't forget this hate crime happened.
Denouncing bigotry and hate is the one thing we can do to demonstrate that black lives matter.
People Saturday night let the Horn family know they're not alone.
Amazing grace, how sweet.
Horn's family says though he is still in a coma, he's improving.
He's yawning like he wants to wake up. And those are good things. He's opening up his eyes.
And then his eyes start flickering. And they open slowly. And then he's looking at you. And then you say, hey, Sean's going to come out of this. You got his son to raise. Mm-hmm. He's not done living.
As Horn's family waits for him to wake up, they're finding strength in faith.
I'm mad. I'm angry. Let's not get it wrong. But I forgive him. You know, I do. I forgive him. And I gave that to God.
As far as the suspect in this crime, Julian Tumagawa, he's 18 years old. He'll be arraigned in court Monday, and many people who are here at the vigil tonight tell me they will also be there in court to see his arraignment. Horn's family tells me they are hoping to hear that he will plead guilty. That way they can move on past this and focus on Horn's healing. Live at Harborview, I'm Didi Sun, Cairo 7 News.
Hitler had the supreme fascist state. And what was he worried about in Europe and in Germany? He was worried about white genetic annihilation. What is everybody in Europe worried about now? Why genetic annihilation? All these people from Syria coming up in here.
Unfortunately, recently in Italy, we had a significant terrorist event. Talking Points memo explains Luca Traini, 28 years old, remained jailed as police investigated him on multiple counts of attempted murder with the aggravating circumstance of racial hatred for the Saturday attacks in the Italian city of Macerata. Oh my God, man, ISIS sent this guy, huh? We got to figure out what the hell is going on here. So we got to block all these Muslims. Oh, he's not Muslim. Huh, that's interesting. Oh, he targeted immigrants because he's a right winger. Huh. No wonder I haven't seen a tweet from Donald Trump about this. Let's give you more. Italian authorities said they seized Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf and other publications linked to Nazism and a flag with a Celtic cross, a symbol commonly used by white supremacists from Traini's home on Sunday. So who did he target? The five men and one woman wounded in a two-hour drive-by shooting spree are from Nigeria, Ghana, Gambia, and Mali, according to RAI State Television. I guess we got to stop all immigration from Italy until we figure out what the hell's going on. I mean, we got a responsibility to protect Americans, and if it turns out they've got these kind of white supremacist terrorists in Italy, a place known for fascism before, we got to make sure we're safe. We got to figure out what the hell's going on. I'm just applying Donald Trump standards, right? If you're unsure, you never know, some members of a group do terrorism, well, you got to block everybody from the group. The Italians, I'm done with them. Sorry, John Iadarola. I don't know how John Iadarola, one of our hosts, got here. Might have been chain migration. We got to look into it. Maybe end it and send him back. The suspect was an unsuccessful candidate last year in local election for the anti-migrant Northern League political party. Italy's ANSA news agency quoted acquaintances saying he previously had ties with the neo-fascist Forza Nuova and Casa Pound parties. Some stuff he put on his forehead. Let's take a look at his picture. Might give you a sense of it as well. That's a swastika. Not really subtle. Hey, you know what? It's not fair to call it a Italian ban. Maybe we should just make it a right-wing ban from all the different countries. Until we figure out what the hell is going on, right? Because to be fair to Italy, and we don't want to discriminate against Italy, it might be a lot of countries we have to ban because of right-wingers that come from those countries that commit horrible acts of terrorism. Weird, though, that there hasn't been nonstop press about this issue. Because I know that if there's an act of terrorism, especially if it's politically motivated, driven against certain groups, our press goes nuts over it, and Donald Trump goes nuts over it, and the Republicans go nuts over it. Unless it's a right-wing terrorist, as is, by the way, the majority of terrorist acts in the United States. So, now, final piece of irony here. Some people think were outraged because a Nigerian immigrant had assaulted an Italian woman recently, a 29-year-old identified as Jennifer, in a shooting spree. They then asked about the people who were shot by Traini, and we go to that portion of the story here. Jennifer was shot by Traini. This is the earlier shooting by the immigrant. A Nigerian man has been arrested in the death of Pamela Mastro Pietro, 18 years old. Her remains were found in two suitcases days after she walked away from a drug rehab community. So a horrible crime. Assaulted, murdered, chopped up, put into suitcases. When an immigrant does a horrible crime, everyone from that community is held responsible by some, particularly in the right wing. When a right winger does a crime, or a white supremacist does a crime, or an Italian does a crime, the entire right wing community is not held responsible. All white supremacists are not held responsible. and obviously all Italians are not held responsible. Now, let me add, nor should they. Of course they shouldn't. That's preposterous. But when it comes to one group in particular, our media and our right wing lose their minds. The one exception is, of course you can't hold all Italians accountable, but yes, Muslims, it's a particularly dark religion. It's the one that creates all these problems. Hey, we got to figure out what the hell is going on, and we got to do a Muslim slash travel ban. So when it comes to that, there is demagoguery. When it comes to these, oh wow, I mean, look, there was the immigrant who was killed, or the immigrant who did the killing, etc. Well, let's now go to the irony that I was mentioning earlier. A Nigerian community leader in Makarata, Sammy Kanon, said he heard the shots as he was going to meet with cultural mediators about organizing a sit-in to support Mastro Pietro's family. That's the poor woman who was killed. And unfortunately, salt in the wounds here, they called off the event after the shootings for fear of further racist attacks. So you hear sometimes from the right wing, why won't the fill in the blank, Muslims, Mexicans, immigrants, call out their own? Here were the Nigerians going to support the Italian victim in this case, and they were shot while going to support the victim. Why won't other Italians call out Luca Traini? By the way, they do. Of course they do. The government has apprehended him, etc. Why won't other right wingers call out Luca Traini? They actually won't. White supremacists? Yeah, good luck with that. So, unlike the other side, we do not believe that everyone in that category is responsible for Luca Traini's crimes. Luca Traini is responsible for those crimes. It would be nice if both sides used the same standards.
For the first time, scientists here in Britain have grown human eggs in a laboratory. The researchers at the University of Edinburgh removed egg cells from ovary tissue at their earliest stage of development and grew them to the point at which they were ready for fertilisation. The tissue was taken from volunteers who were giving birth by caesarean section. Professor Evelyn Telfer is from the School of Biological Sciences at Edinburgh University, and Dan Damon asked her who this breakthrough could end up helping.
If it could reach clinical practice, then it would be most applicable to young women who are looking at fertility preservation if before they underwent damaging treatments such as chemotherapy or radiotherapy.
So you're intervening in the process of the egg developing. That's what you've been able to do, to identify a part of that process.
Well, at the moment, clinically, young women, before chemotherapy, they have a small piece of their ovary removed and stored for later use, you know, once they're healthy. And the only option to use that is to transplant it. So that tissue is available, but that tissue contains very, very immature eggs. So what we've been able to do is to use that tissue and grow those very immature eggs all the way to the point of, you know, full maturation, so the point at which they would be ready to be fertilised. But we need to show that these eggs are indeed healthy and normal, and we haven't been able to show that at this stage.
What would you need to do to prove that?
Yeah, well, there's various things that we have to do in terms of the actual process itself, and that's what we're working on. But the next big step is to get these eggs that we grow in the culture system, to get them and attempt to fertilise them. Now, that's something that we would require authority from. We'd need to apply for a licence to the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority, and if we were allowed to, then we would test them. And that, of course, would be the next big step. Once we've tested their ability to be fertilised, we can then do a whole series of tests to determine whether these eggs are indeed normal.
Because what you'd be doing, in effect, if you get that permission, is to develop a viable embryo. I think under the rules, you're not allowed to let that embryo develop more than a few hours.
Yeah, that's correct about the rules. And of course, what you would do if it was allowed by the regulatory body, you would test these embryos in terms of looking at their molecular profile, because we have a lot of information about what should be happening at that very early stage of embryonic development. So within the regulations that are set down, we could get a lot of information.
Slightly silly, scary science question, Professor Telfer. Is this another step on the way to creating a human outside a human?
I don't think so, no.
Tell me why not.
Because I think developing a human, developing the embryo and developing the fetus and getting to the point where you have a viable offspring is an incredibly complicated process. And I know, of course, there are people working at each of these stages and in animal models. But, you know, this has taken us almost 30 years to get to the point where we can actually get these human eggs to be grown outside the body. We could do this in mouse, you know, almost 20 years ago. So, you know, if that does happen, it certainly will not be in my lifetime.
Professor Evelyn Telfer from the School of Biological Sciences at Edinburgh University. And she was talking to Dan Damon.
The white sphinxes go to the bottom of the ocean and study one grain of sand, bring it and put it under a microscope. The black person passes by and say, "What are you doing there, Ralph?" "See, I'm studying this grain of sand that I got 8,000 feet from the bottom of the ocean." "And what are you studying a grain of sand for?" "I'm studying it because it's there. And I'm going to find out why it's there. And I'm going to find out everything about it. How it got there, what it does while it was there, what it can be used for by me." To dominate you.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, February 10th, 2018, so I have been told. This is our weekly, although it has been 2 months since we have been on the air. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. We were on last week, but 2 months since we've done a compensatory call-in. Our weekly broadcast, generally, every Saturday, where it's specifically designed for victims of white supremacy, black people, to have a forum where we can dial in, discuss things that have happened over the last 7 days, locally, nationally, globally, with regards to racism, white supremacy, counter-racism. People have strategies, suggestions on things we should be doing to solve this problem as soon as possible. The number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Quickly, before we get to some of the folks, if you have commentary that you would like to share, a few things that I want to touch on before we get to the callers. First and foremost, we are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Almost a decade, our 9-year anniversary this month of counter-racist broadcasting. Hopefully we have been helpful, constructive with regards to non-white people getting a more accurate understanding of what white supremacy racism is, how it works, what it means to be classified as white. You can invest, hit the blog racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop us an email. We can get you a physical mailing address. Because of the flood, my physical mailing address changed. So anybody, if you are interested in mailing any support, you'll have to drop an email to get the new physical address. Any of the folks who are interested in supporting, helping out with regards to the flood, certainly you can use my PayPal. You can also nab any items from my wish list at Amazon.com. I can even give you a quick anecdote as a part of the catastrophe, the flood. I just got from my wish list, no less, I think like in October, just got a great bamboo bath brush. I'd said like self-care. I was doing that even before the flood happened and recognizing the importance of that and getting soaps that I like, just things to things that are constructive to build your body up so that I could feel better going about doing the work of counter racism. I had my great brush. I packed it to take with me with the flood, but I had used it the day of the flood. And they say you have to leave it out so it'll dry or it'll get moldy because of the moisture. And so I packed it. It was still wet and forgot about it. And then when I went back after a day or so, whatever, after all the, you know, chaos with the flooding and having to get moved around and all that stuff. And of course, it was all icky and what have you from being packed for a day. So I lost it. And then I could not find an adequate replacement. And, you know, it was just one annoyance in a month of thousands of annoyances, and certainly small on the list in comparison to the flood. But I mean, that was just one other thing to mess up my bath time. But listener nabbed, I put a replacement brush on my wish list and I got it this week. And man, that was one thing that did add a small bit of pleasure to experience on the plantation of white supremacy. So much obliged to folks who have invested, supported the cows, many people who reached out to ask how they can help and support since the flood situation. Much obliged. And again, I hope the program is worthy of your time and energy. Other things I wanted to touch on. The segment where my BFF, Amy Goodman, Democracy Now!, where earlier this week they were talking with Dr. Harry Edwards, a former guest on The Cows, 2010, where they were talking with him, black male, about the use of Dr. Martin Luther King and his speech about the drum major for justice and that being used to peddle Dodge Ram trucks, vehicles. Dr. Harry Edwards, he is a victim of white supremacy. He has VGQ, Victim Guarantee Qualified. He can say whatever he wants to about racism. My BFF, Amy Goodman, is a suspected racist of the highest order. That is a major pattern that I've observed with her over the years, where they will bring on black people, non-white people, to criticize other non-white people. It's valid. We read Coretta Scott King's biography, My Life, My Love, My Legacy, last year. She talked about the use and or misuse of her husband's legacy. She talked about that. That's something that has been talked about. No problem. If anyone wants to ask questions, if they were involved or, you know, what they have to say about the ad, that's fine. And they have VGQ as well. But the people that are most to blame are the individuals that I suspect are white, with the Dodge Ram Company. Those are the folks that paid for that commercial. It would be real easy to offer some victims of white supremacy, King family or other, offer them some money or whatever else to get to coerce them to agree with whatever it is you're going to do with this commercial. And I've seen that pattern on Democracy Now! Consistently in that segment. If you notice, they switched the focus and the blame to the King family, the people that are most to blame. Every time, all the time, they are white. White men, white women, white children. Next, there was a lot of hoopla about the Black Panther film. I feel the same way about Black Panther as I do about Get Out. Released at the same time, no less. That came out Black History Month of 2017. The film I was more excited about that came out this week was the PBS Independent Lens documentary on Winnie Mandela. Wow. Fantastic. I would highly recommend folks watch it. I do think it's interesting that they released that film during February, quote unquote, Black History Month in this part of the world. Generally, it's been my observation, racists avoid that sort of thing. Like Black History Month in England is in October. It's not aligned so that you'd have black people around the globe all celebrating Black History Month at the same time. Generally, they don't do that sort of thing. But to have this documentary in February, almost as though we should be thinking about what she was fighting against in South Africa and what black people are talking about to some degree during the month of February, is one and the same. That generally racists avoid that sort of thing. It's been my experience, but it's awesome. She talks in detail about her philosophy on counter violence. It goes into great detail about the elaborate local, national, global surveillance that white supremacists had constructed against the Mandela family, Winnie, her husband, obviously, everybody, black people in total in that part of the world. And they talked to some of the race soldiers who were carrying out these orders. Just a lot of great detail, archival footage. It's available online. You can watch it. And I think it aired this week on PBS, like on television, but I think it'll be back later in the month. Great material. Would encourage folks to check it out, study. Great counter-racist viewing. last thing that I will get in, a listener, excuse me, maybe I should have some water. A listener contacted me, I think right at the end of last week, and she sent me a notice that there was going to be some sort of event. It's called the White Ally Toolkit. It's going to be happening in Seattle. And she said, if I buy you a ticket, will you attend? And as I just mentioned, I'm a flood victim. My house just flooded. I have no idea when my housing situation will be resolved. A daily stress. We've done one broadcast in the last 2 months that is unheard of in the history of the cows, at least the last since 2009, the last 9 years. And, you know, having so much to deal with, I really was not looking to, you know, add anything to my schedule right now. As I said, I've been, you know, on an aggressive yoga kick and just trying to do self-care. And, you know, yoga has helped me preserve a little bit of sanity under very, very traumatic circumstances. And so I was looking forward to doing a yoga class this morning with a black female instructor, no less, with natural hair. She's gorgeous. I took her class last week. That is what I was looking forward to doing with my Saturday morning. But this event that a listener wanted me to check out, it was in Queen Anne. And if folks, if you heard the broadcast that we did last week when we returned to the air, as a result of the flood, my first temporary residence for about a month or so after the flood was in Queen Anne. And I hadn't spent a whole lot of time in this area in the time that I've lived in Seattle, but to have just lived there. And then when I looked at the address for this event was at a white church on the exact same street where I was just staying days ago. Literally, I used to walk right past about a few blocks away from where this church is. I used to walk right past there every day, sometimes multiple times a day, going to my yoga class. I've stated consistently, there are no coincidences. Time is right and exact. I just read that as a sign that I should be in attendance for this event. So I contacted the white reverend at the church, contacted her via email, and it was a $20 fee. And I said, as a black person, you know, I don't think I should have to pay to attend the event. I want to attend. And she said that was fine. So I went and I informed a cows listener who resides in the Seattle area. They were able to attend as well. And I can even give out a quick suggestion. I've said this before. If you're going to attend any sort of event on racism, white supremacy, counter-racism, if you're going with another non-white person and they are codified to some degree, even if you all don't, you know, have identical code, they understand counter-racism concepts. They are familiar, you know, Mr. Fuller's ideas about counter-racism, Dr. Welsing, right? They have some understanding. If you go, try not to sit together. I found that that works wonderful. My observation, if you sit together, right, black people, non-white people, you all sit together, even if it's a group, even if it's a majority black crowd event, if you're talking about racism and you're being honest about things, following logic, a lot of times that can upset people or make people uncomfortable. If it's a group of you all and you're all sitting together, you can just be You can become one entity to be disregarded, ignored, just to have contempt thrown at all of you collectively as though you are one person when it's actually a collective. You can totally obliterate that if you don't sit together, right? When you don't sit together and you all are just, you speak individually, united, independent, it totally eliminates that. And they can no longer, in my view, what it does, it becomes, they cannot just attack any ideas or what has been said and just say, oh, that group, that entity is crazy. We'll just ignore those crazy niggers or disregard them. It becomes less focused on it being about who said what and it just being about, is this logical? Does it make sense? We'll just have to evaluate these ideas and we can't just dismiss this as the crazy element in the crowd. I have found that it works wonderful when you can do that. Anyway, we went to the event. I was seated by myself. I got there early. I was able to sit up front. Unfortunately, this event, again, the White Ally Toolkit, that's what this was about, was run, facilitated by a black male. Knew, you know, from the very beginning, I already know I do not think this is going to be very constructive, but I am intrigued because the audience is going to be almost exclusively white. So we go. It's about maybe 50 people in attendance at a church in Queen Anne, as I said last week, super, super white area of Seattle, even whiter than most. And they started at like 9 a.m. this morning, and they give no definition for racism. That right there, immediately, I already know, again, this is not going to be anything serious. They're not trying to have any authentic discussion to solve this problem. So they have you, they have us seated in tables that seat like 5 to 6 people. This is not like rows or pew seating, even though it's in a church. So they have us break into smaller groups and do like an introduction and why you're here and that sort of thing. So we're talking in the small group. I'm with like 5 white people, 3 white females, and 1 white male are in the group with me. And so we go around, I give my definition of racism. The only definition of racism that I heard the entire day from anyone who had a microphone or who spoke with me, I give my definition of racism, white supremacy. White woman who was seated to my left wrote my definition down verbatim. Everyone at the table, I asked if they were white. They, everyone said yes, and they all agreed that that definition of racism was accurate. They all agreed that such a system existed. The facilitator for this event, David Camp is his name, black male, Dr. David Camp. His card said he's from North Carolina. He, in his introduction, he said that we were to assume that everyone in attendance was there with good intentions. And I immediately looked at that like, wow, that does not seem logical at all. And I told the group, I do not agree with that. And I do not assume that any of you here at this table or any other white person in this room or anywhere on this earth has good intentions as it relates to black people. And in my view, that's obvious why I should think that way. Does anyone here think it's illogical for me to think that way? And they all immediately said, oh, yeah, totally logical. I totally agree. And I didn't agree with that point either about everyone coming here with good intentions. We continue. All of this got recorded, by the way. I'm just trying to pick out some of the things that stood out to me as being important in all of this. So no definition of racism. We're supposed to assume that people there had correct intentions. We continue. And I was saying that, you know, I do not assume that, you know, folks here have correct intentions. And I don't even assume that, you know, you all here came really with any sort of motivation to end white supremacy. I was obviously the only person using the term white supremacy. White woman was there with her daughter, 16-year-old daughter, and she speaks up immediately and she says, well, wait a minute now. I came here this morning and I'm being attacked. I'm here. I'm doing the work. And I said, oh, you're being attacked? How are you being attacked exactly? And she says, well, I mean, you're saying that us coming here, that doesn't mean anything. And she talks a little while. She said, well, maybe not attacked. And so she stops and the black male, he goes back and he, you know, continues with this whole workshop, which is supposed to be about giving white people ways that they can talk to other white people. I think the term that he uses is racism skeptics. That was the term that he was using. This is supposed to be about giving suggestions, ways that white people can talk to white people who deny that racism exists, or they make statements that suggest that they're racist, saying that they don't like Black Lives Matter and that sort of thing, giving white people advice on how they can talk to, question these white people and maybe get them to, you know, think differently about the whole race matter. That's what this is supposed to be about. So fast forwarding, we get to maybe an hour and a half later into all of this. And he says, oh, and music, I forgot that the lack of seriousness cannot be understated. There was one point where he was kind of asking the crowd questions like, how old are you? What's your income range? Do you have friends who express racist views? He's asking just a lot of different types of questions. And he would ask a question and we all had our little clickers so that we could vote and he could get the poll results immediately. He would ask a question and he would give us maybe 25 seconds or so to answer. In those seconds, he would play a song. And so he would play a question like, are you a white person? Or he would ask a question like, are you a white person? Or are you, to use their nomenclature, a person of color, right? And given 20 seconds to answer the question, he would play like Stevie Wonder, Ebony and Ivory. And, you know, the white people in the crowd would giggle at all the, you know, different song choices. And I looked at some of the white people there and I told all the white people in my group, I just said that, you know, to me just says we're not serious. I mean, if we're talking about a serious problem, I'm not going to ask you a question and then play a song or a ditty. Every time I ask you a serious question about white supremacy or race, I mean, people are dying every day about this and we're, you know, giggling and such. Anyway, we get to a point about an hour and a half in or so, and he says, okay, we're going to divide up people into different groups based on how you respond. So the two questions were, one, when someone says or does something racist, and he had examples, do you have like a visceral emotional response? And so based on your answer to that question, you would get a certain score. And then the next question was, do you respond? Like the frequency of how often you respond? Do you say something? Do you engage when a white person makes like a racist statement or a racist comment? So my score ended up being very low, about as low as you could get on both of those questions. In the first question, I had a very low emotional response when white people make racist comments or statements. And the next one was, do you engage? And most of the time, I do not engage the white person when they practice racism. So this put me in the group that he called analysts. And he said, for this group, these are people who seem to understand racism. They seem to be aware of racism, but they don't necessarily engage. They don't necessarily go and do something always, but they're processing. They're thinking about it. He said, this group, I'm the most confused about. I don't understand these people at all. And the other groups, it was like the scouts, the people who just kind of assess the situation and try to figure out what to do. He had another group that was the warriors, the people that always go and confront. He had, I think it was four or five different groups of people, but the analysts, the group that I ended up being in, that he said was the smallest group. In fact, it was so small that he almost combined that group with another group because that was also a small group as well. Anyway, one of the, depends on how you view it, in my view, one of the wild things that happened, significant, no coincidence things that happened when he, because he made us move, he made us get up from where we originally voluntarily sat to go sit with our group, right? So when he did this, I went from sitting in the front of the room with my all-white table at the frontmost part of the church to being at the back of the room, the absolute back of the room, with possibly the only other non-white person in attendance who coincidentally happened to be a Cows listener. I thought that was absolutely amazing, perhaps even beautiful how that worked out, that was how I ended up sitting with the Cows listener. Was we were the only two members of that group, which I also thought was hugely significant as well. The analyst group only comprised of Cows listeners. So he goes around and asks people questions about what they came up with and all this other commentary. It goes on. I spoke, the Cows listener who was present spoke. At the end, I was able to get in my commentary that I did not think white people could be talked out of practicing white supremacy racism, that they are dedicated to terrorizing non-white people globally, and that if white people are not going to change their mind on this, then we need to have a more accurate, logical, honest conversation on this subject matter. And I told them I didn't think that we had had that this morning. Again, all of this got recorded. The white woman who said that I attacked her when I was giving my views, her 16-year-old daughter stopped me as we were getting up from the table to go relocate to our group, as I was going to the back of the room that I didn't know at the time. 16-year-old daughter stops me and she says, "So if you think all of this is nonsense, what should we be doing?" And I said, "Tell the truth. That's what white people can do. If you all say, hey, what can we do? Be honest. If the truth is white people are committed to practicing racism and we're not going to stop, just say that. Then we can have a more accurate, honest conversation in going about the solution with the understanding that we're going to have to force white people to stop practicing racism." She says, "Okay." And she said, "Well, what would we need to do to force white people to stop practicing racism?" And I say, "Well, that would be a totally different conversation than what we're talking about today, yes?" And she says, "Yes." I said, "Oh, okay." I said, from today, the whole basis is that white people can be talked out of practicing racism. I haven't seen any evidence that that's true. Have you seen any evidence today, or have you heard any evidence that white people can be talked out of practicing racism?" And she thought about it for a second, and then she put her head down and she said, "No." Let's start right there. Just start with the truth. And her white mother was seated like behind her, and she was looking at this whole exchange. In my view, she gave me the nastiest scowl, as though she had heard this exchange and was not pleased. Maybe she didn't. She can give her own interpretation, but that was my view. It looked like she gave me a scowl. The mom came up and talked to me at the end of all this as well, because I stated publicly, even though I didn't name her, I stated that a white person had said something racist at the meeting earlier today, and I was talking about her, although I didn't name her. She came over to me and said, I thought that you were talking about me, and yeah, I shouldn't have said that I was attacked. She did the whole sexism thing. She said, "Well, it just comes from a place of me being a woman, and you don't know how many times I've been on my job, and men have just talked over me, and I have had to speak up to have my voice heard." And I thought she was going to bust out a Me Too hashtag. I mean, wow. At the end of the day, after she said all of that, I just came back to, "Oh yeah, ma'am, do you think that you could have said, I'm being attacked by a black person talking about racism? Do you think that that could have come out of a place of racism?" And she said, "Oh yeah, 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 And she put her head down like she was going to cry for a second. Man, I think all of that, even what she said afterward, I think all of that got recorded. I haven't had time because it's been a busy full day, but I think that all got recorded, so I'll be able to share. I can upload it to the podcast and I can upload it to SoundCloud as well. But wowee, it was quite a Saturday morning. There were times where I still thought, man, I could have been working on my abs at yoga this morning, but might have been constructive, at least to get to hang out with other cows, listener, for a little while, exchange views on racism and ask whites questions. I think that's always worth sharpening, practicing. With that, we'll get to listeners. The number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you could take about 5 minutes to share your commentary, I'm sure folks have forgotten, might be out of practice. About 5 minutes or so, make sure everyone gets an opportunity to speak. If you could speak one time and then allow everyone else to get at least one turn speaking, that way everyone gets an opportunity to share. I'm sure we'll have ample time if you have other remarks or questions that you would like to ask. For this broadcast, I am sure folks are out of practice. Reminder, if we could not use metaphors, I would be super grateful. It's been my experience that one of the ways racists practice deception, the use, skillful use of metaphors, they will compare two entities and speak as though they are equivalent. And frequently, it is not the case at all. That's one of the ways that they confound and confuse non-white people. victims of white supremacy, we've been exposed to this behavior for a number of years. It has strongly influenced our thought, speech, action, and many of us, Gusty Renegade included, we are still learning, still thinking. We have not come to conclusions on certain matters, which is totally fine. But sometimes, since we do not have the logic, we haven't come to a conclusion, we will substitute a metaphor for logic. That is not acceptable. Frequently, that just adds to the confusion and the lack of clarity. If you need more time to think, it is no problem saying, I will have to think about this a little more, and then I can share my thoughts. No problem. That is outstanding. I have to do that myself often, but no metaphors. If we could be direct, explicit about what it is we would like to say, that would be most appreciated. If you know you're in a noisy environment, if you could watch the noise, that would be great as well. Use your mute button. Just helps to preserve the quality of the broadcast, and people don't have to fight over a lot of excess noise. If you know you got the TV on in the background, you're around other folks who are, you know, chatting, being noisy, much obliged. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary you would like to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello, can I be heard?
Greetings, Puff.
Greetings. Hello, and I would like to make two comments. The first is a singing comment. Hello, Gus. It's so nice to have you back where you belong. And the second comment is about the things that you had planned before you came on the air. I noticed that I just wanted to point out a white pattern. The white pattern is about the eggs and all that, harvesting eggs in Brazil or whatever. To me, that's to add to the white population. I think that they're doing all this genetic research and everything to increase the white population. The second comment, I just want to have empathy for you for going through that workshop. I don't know if you paid for it or not, but that sounds like a heck of a workshop. And sorry that you had to go through that. And that's it. Welcome back to the air. I'm so glad this is a very constructive use of everybody's Saturday listening to this show, and I'm glad you're back. And that's it.
Much obliged, Puff. I think that's the first time anyone has sung anything to Gus on the cows. Broadcast first. might be correct on the eggs as well, with what they're doing with fertilizing, growing their own fertilizing eggs and what have you. I think you are correct on that as well. Why I played Mr. Fuller sound clip after that was over. No empathy for the workshop today, though. That was counter-racist work. That was just being on my assignment. I was glad I had the time and ability to attend. See, other folks who dialed in, appreciate it, Puff. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you had commentary you wanted to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
I heard both of you. Emmy, you can go first.
I'll be quick. I did want to follow the female caller that just spoke, because that was actually the clip I wanted to spend, like, that I wanted to address first. One, welcome back. I'm very grateful for the cows and very grateful for the work that you do. I'm also very grateful that you include a lot of scientific clips throughout the compensatory calls that I listen to. I'm so grateful for that. So please include more, because I enjoy listening to them. I'm learning a lot. Let me put it like that. That's more correct. I'm learning a lot listening to them. And the reason I'm so, captivated by that last clip is that I've always been wondering, you know, the increase in so-called interracial dating or marriage or just quote-unquote biracial children and all that. And I was like, that just doesn't seem to flow well with what I originally was thinking. And I kept thinking, well, why would white people do this? And I know one is to have the white women and the white men confuse more non-white people. I've considered that. I said, okay, that works. And then the second one is that they create a buffer population of confused non-white children. Okay, I totally get that. And I was like, but over time, and even if those non-white children then go to mate with other white children, they still included the original non-white gene in their genetics. So that still, they would still be there. So how could, like, what, you know, what's going on? But then all of that could possibly be true. And then if they've already accepted that they cannot reproduce well on their own with two white people getting together because of their recessive genetic state, then they would have to incorporate some of our genes in order to get some of that mixing. Because they're such a small population, they're pretty much just inbred over and over and over again, which creates a lot of deformities and a lot of diseases, and also infertility. And so, like, that's just a thing, like the mule. So anyway, if they're able to isolate the egg and make the egg become a baby outside of necessarily being inside of a woman, which I think that woman might have been practicing racism. I don't know if she's white or not, but I think the answer to the question is yes. That is a very large step towards maybe not necessarily cloning, but producing children outside of the womb. And if that's the case, then also in the addition of having mapped the entire human genome, they'd be able to calculate and erase those deformities and those diseases. So although I've originally considered that there would be a decrease in the white population, that's not necessarily true because they've already calculated that and decided to take that out of quote-unquote God's hands. And so now once they're able to make the babies and then go and genetically alter the babies, that's a whole new, like, true race and breed of people that we'll have to deal with who will be even more psychotic and psychopathic than their original white ancestors. The last thing, and then the Baltimore clip, that's all I kept hearing was wisdom of psychopaths, wisdom of psychopaths. Like, these are the people that police force want. And then the last thing, the Black Panther clip, I have not seen the movie. I don't have tickets to see the movie. But I was fascinated with the repetitive use of certain words such as fantasy, make believe, real life cannot provide, that's a direct quote, ancient myth. And then I didn't understand why the guy didn't give the film a 10 out of 10. I just felt like if you were going to support Black and you're Black, then why not give a 10 out of 10? But then also that Disney specializes in the selling of dreams and fantasies. The reason that's important to me is that I remember listening to a clip of Dr. Welsing, and she kept talking about that that's what separates children from adults, is that children live in fantasy and adults live in reality. Thank you for listening.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Awesome.
Oh, greetings, Mr. Steele. Yeah. I didn't recognize. It's been so long. I'm out of practice.
Yeah. I guess if we're going to continue with the theme of seeing your return, welcome back. And that's all I'm going to do. But thanks for returning and thanks for bringing the cows back. It's a really good program, and you know, ever since you've left us and you've had your troubles to deal with, it just seems like the online space of Black commentators have it just hasn't been the same without you. There's just been a lot less codification. There's been a lot more confusion, and confusion is deadly. And it's just an improvement that you're back. Thanks. Also, I wanted to talk about the Black Panther reaction and the story that was played, or the clip that was played earlier in the broadcast. You know, the guy mentioned that this comic or cartoon or whatever you want to call it, this story, Black Panther, this media property, made him go back to a time he initially wanted to say 12, and then he revised his answer to say something like 6 or 7. And, you know, I have just been... I've been really disappointed in a lot of my fellow victims and in their reaction to this film. I feel like the white supremacists have essentially infantilized us to the point where we are so starved of attention and I guess recognition from them that we are willing to act like children and revert to a childlike state whenever they satiate our need for this recognition. And it's just been really, really disappointing to observe the focus and the attention that's been given to what is a media property that was created by suspected white supremacists and that is being promoted by suspected white supremacists. Just it's really disappointing. One clip that really disturbed me associated with this Black Panther situation is the clip of the entire school of children singing and dancing and in reaction to being given free tickets to attend the film. And I mean, if you do a little more research, you'll find that the school is the same school with the principal, the suspected white supremacist principal. I think his name is Joe Clark, and he's responsible for having all the showcasing black children singing and dancing instead of studying extra hard. So he, you know, kind of created those clips that we saw in the past couple of years of Black children singing and dancing. And I don't know, it's completely exploitative. It just is another viral video that this guy has created with his students being used as props. And I feel that, Black people, victims of white supremacy, we're being misled by this media property in ways that we can't even quantify or understand right now. And another word that I hear being used associated with this film is the word justice. You know, a lot of victims of racism are saying that, you know, this film is doing justice, or the another phrase I'm hearing is this film is doing right by us. And again, just very disappointing. We haven't even seen the film. We don't know what is being depicted necessarily. Some of the imagery I don't agree with. And, you know, some of the aspects of the film, like the fact that the main character doesn't appear to have a female love interest. It's just more typical Hollywood hogwash. So I really don't appreciate it. And I guess that's my first contribution for the evening. I'll mute my line at this time. Thank you so much.
Appreciate that, Mr. Steele.
Yes,
we can hear you as well.
Hi, I'm a first-time caller. Nice to finally call in. It's nice to have you back, Gus. I'm a little nervous. And the first clip, one of the earlier clips about the Black Panther movie. About the clips about the movie Black Panther. I think it has a lot to do with white validation, because like the white studios, Disney is in charge of producing the movie, and it's like seeing all these Black people excited to see this film. It's really nauseating, to be honest. About the biker clip, I thought that was really interesting as well. The biker clip, the event at the beach and stuff, it's like, I'm with Mr. Fuller that, you know, it's kind of sad that the Black people you can't have time to like party and celebrate. But like you like to say, you know, we're at war. Like Mr. Fuller says, we're at war. So I don't think we really should be celebrating. I really don't know how I feel about that biker clip. And I also wanted to call because I needed some advice. A few weeks ago, a black female I was talking to basically dumped me. And, you know, it kind of hurt a little bit because basically she dumped me over my views on racism, white supremacy, and how I like to bring up, you know, the Kress theory, Dr. Frances Cresswell thing and her teaching, and Mary Fuller Jr. And, you know, it kind of hurt. I don't know how I felt. I feel like a punk a little bit about having her, you know, just say that, oh, I can't talk to you because, you know, your views on white people. She said she had a lot of white friends, and my views on homosexuality, anti-sexual behavior, because she said she has a lot of homosexual friends as well. And it's like, you know, she said because of my views, she couldn't rock with me anymore. So it was like really, and you know, I really like the girl, but again, you know, I'm young, I'm 21, so it's definitely going to be other girls, but it was like, that was the first time a girl ever, you know, dumped me over my views on racism, white supremacy. So, you know, if anybody has any advice, it would really be appreciated. Thank you.
First time caller. I'm glad you were able to dial in. Yes, sir. Give me 1 second, Thomas in New York. The piece that you were seeking input from listeners, other folks can share their thoughts as we proceed. I think I've heard that from a number of listeners over the years in terms of whoever their partner is, male or female, not agreeing with their views on racism and that even causing conflict in the relationship, perhaps even dissolving the relationship, the lack of agreement on racism, white supremacy. I don't think you should feel like a punk. That was the way you phrased it. I don't think you should feel like a punk if she said, hey, I don't think this is going to work between us because of your views on racism. I have a lot of white friends and I have a lot of homosexual friends and, you know, your wacky views and your pals, Dr. Welsing and these folks, I don't agree with them. So I'm going to have to part ways. Certainly it's logical to feel bad about it. You said you liked her and, you know, that's logical. That's human. But with regards to racism, white supremacy, that is very common. That's why we have this program, the compensatory call-in. That's what we are compensating for. Many, many victims, black people, non-white people, many, many non-white people who are victims of white supremacy have been confused and have a similar perspective that a black person, particularly if it's a black person who is using counter-racist logic in analyzing this problem, using the most accurate terms in talking about this problem, many non-white people reject that. They don't want to hear that. And, you know, you're going to have to get out of here. I'm not with that at all. That's very common. And sometimes that's just good to know up front. That way, before things get too far along, you kind of know what that person's perspective on racism, white supremacy is. And if they're going to be acceptable with your views before things get, you know, too far ahead. If anything, I guess you could take it as a learning lesson in that perspective to maybe make that a topic that you get to a little bit earlier to see in terms of compatibility, what are if you're talking to a young lady, what are her views on racism, white supremacy? Is she going to be acceptable with mine before we get too tied up? And then, you know, this just becomes something else that's disappointing for someone. That'd be my thoughts. Other folks, feel free to share if you have any thoughts or suggestions for our first time caller. Thomas in New York, thank you so much for your patience. Proceed, sir.
Absolutely, Josh. Thank you. I'm not going to change to you. I'm tough, man. I'm going to call tough and see if I can get a deal. You know, can still stick to comedy, though. Just so good. But what the young man is saying, man, yeah, that's in my opinion. Off the bat, those are questions you should be asking. To me, those are deal breakers for me. You know, I would be like, oh, okay, you know, I don't think that we're compatible, you know, because our views are, I'm not compromising on them. And obviously, you know, she wasn't compromising on her. So I think that this could have been a blessing for you because, trust me, this is from experience. You don't want to be in a relationship with someone who's confused, you know, because that's what I deal with, and trying to explain things and just waiting for stuff to happen so they can see it for themselves. It's just, you know, it's just not a pleasant experience. You know, if I ever get in another relationship, it will be with someone who's less confused. The Myrtle Beach clip, let's not forget that a huge section of Myrtle Beach was owned by a Sada Secure family, the Chesham Arts, and racism, white supremacy is what got them out of that land. But, you know, and this might be uncodified, but the whole premise is stupid to me. If these people are treating you this way and they don't want you in a town and you're spending your money there, don't go there. Then I heard the lady say, oh, Daytona is totally opposite. Well, I will guarantee you if that Black Bike Week was held in Daytona a few years, Myrtle Beach will be promoting these Black people to come 300,000 people deep to spend their money in their city. You know, we're to the point where we're still taking this abuse and trying to integrate back into this thing. And it's just to me terrible that they're sitting there trying to sue people because they want to mistreat them. And you're going to sue them to make them treat you better. It's unbelievable. The Black Panther, I think that the Afrofuturism is needed. We need to see ourselves in the future. I think that it's more important that we win in the past in movies. They'll never put that. But the problem I have with it is if we look at Africa, all of this technology we have all around the world comes from the raw minerals from there, but they have nothing. And now you're going to make this fictitious place up where they're all advanced in the future, in a place with the technology, where all the technology comes from, but they have none of it. You know, it's just white supremacy being practiced in the whole thing. What Ken Steele explained was what I call white validation disease. Blacks looking for white validation is the key to the confusion because whites feed off of that response they get. It's like a drug for them. They get high off of it, and we get high off of getting it. And it's like we need to break that cycle. The human AIDS clip, they got a new Netflix series called Altered Carbon. It sounds exactly like this is a fake. You know, they did it at the Vegas electronic show, but it was set up like it's real. So everyone's thinking, yo, you could go and have a human, just the perfect human that you picked out, you know, with muscle tone and whatever you want, grown in a bag, and then you could take all your memories and thoughts and everything and put it into that other thing, and live your life through that other thing. It sounded like that's where they're going, because China also just cloned a monkey perfectly. So in my opinion, you have whites trying to clone humans, and China cloning a monkey. And if you put those things together, that's where you get white from. So I think that they're trying to find themselves. And the last thing I wanted to say is the King family, one of the most terrorized Black family in the history of the country, proved the government killed their father, her husband, proved the government, the United States government killed them. This was the most hated man ever to walk the face of the earth. Okay, no one even compares to this. This is the most surreal man ever to walk the face of the earth. And then you put him on a Chrysler commercial. Chrysler was a racist. Funded eugenics, big time racist, a crook, a thief. He got rich because he stole the patents to the C.R. Patterson and Sons company. That's the Black owned car company that was competing with Ford and General Motors at the time. He stole their patents and then went to General Motors and got a job as the head of Buick. That's how he got rich. He was a railroad worker and a con man before that. And for them to put him in a Dodge commercial, a company that he started with the Dodge brothers, straight racist and eugenics finance funders. It's just to me terrible, and I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Appreciate that, Thomas, in New York, and definitely appreciate reminding us of Assata Shakur's family in the Carolinas, that they had beachfront property that was stolen from them. I'm using the term stolen deliberately, but definitely appreciate that reminder. And I thought the same thing with regards to the Black Bikers Weekend, the beach phenomenon down in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. I thought the same thing, like when he was saying that they were going to these establishments and that they, I guess they didn't serve the full menu. They would only serve barbecue when it was Black Biker Weekend or what have you, or they wouldn't allow them, you know, in the establishment. They made them go through the drive-through, or they only used, I think he said they only used plastic silverware, paper plates, and what have you, as I guess they would use real silverware and chinaware and what have you, if the whites were going to be present. Like, I am not picketing. I'm not protesting. Like, oh, thank you for the reminder. I'm supposed to be practicing Black self-respect and not eating here to begin with. I don't want an ice cube. I don't want a napkin, a toothpick, nothing. Like, that's not... Yeah, I was thinking the exact same thing during the clip. Black self-respect. Victims of white supremacy, you know, they can make their own decision. But Black self-respect, in my view, should dictate which actions we take, how we respond to racist man, racist woman, racist child. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you have commentary. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Greetings, Red in Nevada.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call, and I won't harp on it too much, but definitely I appreciate you having the show. I guess I'm going to try to share as quick as possible. In December, I had went on vacation with my family, and I wanted to share just a few things from then. So we went to a few states, and we went to New Orleans. And I observed, I guess it was supposed to be a racist joke, but it was, but an action was included in it. I was getting my family and I, we were getting on a boat. And right before you got on the boat, you had to have your, like your room key checked with one of the employees at the entrance. Well, there was a, I would say he was a teenage, maybe mid-teenage, maybe like 15 or something like that. It was a teenage Black male, and he was in front of us. His family must have walked already onto the boat, but it, for the most part, it was just him. And so he goes up to the boat employee. It's this older white suspected racist, and I'll say why, the story will explain the reason why I called her a suspected racist. But she goes up to, he goes up to her, she checks his room key, and she said, and his room key is actually on the lanyard around his neck. And she says, oh, well, you know, if you're a good boy, you know, you would wear your lanyard like this in the regular way, where it's basically his room key is going to be basically sitting on his chest. But he says, well, you know, but then she said, well, if you're bad, you know, what the pirates would do in the old days, they would do this. And what she does is she takes the room key and the lanyard, and she strings it up like behind his neck, so up behind his head, kind of like simulating like a hanging. And he just kind of like, you know, it only lasted for a couple of seconds. So he just stands there, you know, after she does, she kind of has a couple of, you know, she kind of giggles a little bit, and then he proceeds, you know, going to the boat. Now, and of course, she hadn't said anything to me. She didn't care who else saw it. It was me and my younger sister. We saw it, and we kind of, you know, looked at each other like, you know, this is, you know, it is what it is. So that was one thing. I don't know, like I said, if it really qualifies as a racist joke or not. The other thing, I had listened to the show from last week, and I listened to how you spoke about yoga, and I also had a story. A racist story about yoga. I had went to a yoga class at this large gym in here in Nevada. It was several years ago, and I think I might have went with a couple other people. I don't know if these people would now classify themselves as white, but they were non-black, possibly non-white. But we go into the class. I'm kind of like sitting up close to the front. The instructor is an older white woman. I won't say she's older because you really can't tell with them, but she's a white woman. And we get into the first position. And I didn't know how, I guess you have to have, or at least to me, you have to have some type of flexibility to be able to do some of these positions that she wanted you to do. And I couldn't quite do it. And so I assume, like with any other classes that I've been at the same gym, you know, you kind of just go at your own pace or you kind of, you know, do what you can. But I guess that's not how she wanted it to go. She kept basically, you know, singling me out like, no, do this position. Do this position, very stern, very like condescending. And it took me, I left the class and that was because I was so embarrassed. And it took me years to even think about doing any yoga. And the only reason why I even started to even think about doing yoga again is I had went on YouTube and I looked up yoga videos where there are black females in it. And so that kind of motivated me to do yoga. And I feel like I had some other stories. Oh, I went to, me and my family, we went to the Civil Rights Museum in Tennessee around the same time in December. And it was, I felt like, my own opinion, that that museum was not made or put together for black people or non-white people. When you first walk in, there was like this huge sculpture, and it had these figure in it. I think it was in gray granite or it was like a real dark stone, grayish black stone, and it was almost was like they had like these figures kind of slowly ascending to the top of this huge stone. I think it might have been like 10 feet high, something like that. I looked up the stone, and apparently other white people who helped to renovate the museum, they gave this white sculptor who's never done any other black sculptures, because I looked at his website and I don't have his name right in my head right now, but they gave him like $400,000 to do this sculpture. They get into the museum. They have like pictures of the Lincoln Monument. They have this other room where a white photographer, he has all his pictures up of him, that he took during the March on Washington. And then as you go through it, they also show like this video that was made by the Ford Foundation. And it kind of goes through black people's history in the United States. And of course, they spoke about the 13th Amendment, but also, they did not speak about the exception clause. There were a few things like that. The couple of good call-outs, they did have, actual, like the bus that Rosa Parks was actually on, one of the jail cells that Martin Luther King was on. They had a copy of Gil Scott Heron's album, one of his albums, a copy of Negroes with Guns. So there were a few nice things to point out. And I guess I'll leave it there. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Right on, Red, in Nevada. And I'm so glad you got to travel with your family. I'm a big fan of traveling, and the racism, white supremacy is going to be there even if you stay in the same spot. I definitely think that you all experienced a white supremacist joke incident of white terrorism for sure with the lynching simulation. But traveling with family is still great. And definite thanks for your yoga incident. That is, speaking of terrorism, I mean, anyone, if you're familiar with yoga, like that's not what it's supposed to be at all. Like it's just to do what you're interested in doing, not you're supposed to be here and get over there right now. I mean, that is absurd system of racism, white supremacy. And again, you are supposed to be going to do something that is calming, soothing, and you just get traumatized again. Like that happens to black people all over the world in a variety of anyway, for another day, I have to do a whole nother program on white supremacy and yoga. That even came up at the seminar this morning Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if we've not heard from you at all, if you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, everyone. I'm going to try to go as fast as I can so I won't forget what I would like to say. Starting off today, there was a event called the Trayvon Martin Foundation, where the mother and father have some sort of, I think it's a, they may have been a walk. I don't know. I didn't go out there. But apparently it was quite crowded. The reason why I say it is because I stayed within about a mile or less than a mile in this location. And before you could even get close to it, there's cones in the street, police directing traffic. There's this non-white victim of racism, white supremacy by the name of Mr. Jay-Z. He attended. So I think that's probably why it made it such a crowded event, not knowing exactly what the foundation is about and what they're doing. But hopefully they were doing something constructive to end the system of racist white supremacy, which had a lot to do with the murder of their child. Black Panther. When I hear that, to me, it reminds me of the perhaps hundreds of young, at that time in their lives, young, non-white black people who were attempting to come up with answers to the system of racism, white supremacy. And along that path, they were mistreated in all significant ways, including murder. Some of them are still in greater confinement. And I just can't associate that name with, quote unquote, fiction, something called science. And for the most part, the word fiction. As far as that concerned. And so if it sounds like I'm not going to make an effort to go see the movie, then that's exactly what I'm saying. Probably not interested in even seeing it when it comes on, as far as that concerned, but VGQ to anybody who is interested in it. To the quote-unquote young person that stated about his issue involving the, I believe, the ninth area of activity, sex, specifically interaction with other non-white people, in this case, non-white females. I would say, you know, being that you have had that experience, I think a constructive way to learn from it is to, prior to you getting emotionally involved with another person, that you and that person agree to ask questions. And I would place a large capacity of questions to be mentioned to one another. And, you know, kind of like just take it slow, you know, let the person get to know you and you know, get to know the person. They have to be intrinsic. Logically speaking, as long as there's a global system of racist white supremacy, relations between non-white people are not going to be very good. So as Mr. Fuller says, what you have to do is to agree upon that. That is not going to be good, and therefore you would have some sort of workable environment between you and that other person or persons. Yes, I did see the commercial about where Dr. King's voice was used to sell cars. There's also, and I wonder if anybody has saw this, somewhere during that time when that game was being played, remember the scene in Malcolm X where Denzel Washington held up his hand. It was a true incident where he basically guided the FOI on a situation where a fellow member was being mistreated at a police station. That scene where he held up his hand and then the hand pointed, this primarily after, I think that comes from Mr. Lee in the movie, but nevertheless, there was a commercial where there was a non-white male in it. I can't recall on what exactly we were saying, but the music that was in the movie was the same music as this person was doing some kind of speech. And then at the end of the commercial, which was very brief, the commercial was, it was just a website that came up that had something to do with non-white black people. And I wonder if anybody else, I'm being very vague about it. So nobody's probably going to say that they observed this same commercial, but I'm hoping they may have. I noticed that also. Anything else? That's all I have to think of right now. Thank you.
I did not see that commercial. I have to ask if anybody or if any other folks, the Malcolm X or the commercial, I guess, that were using the music from the Malcolm X film and advertising a website or what have you, feel free to share. But I didn't see that one. Other folks, if we have anybody else with us who we have not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, if you have commentary, feel free.
Yes, ma'am, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Let's get the female caller first.
Hello. I'm actually also a new listener and a first-time caller. So I pretty much have observed many of the same things that the previous callers have. But one thing I wanted to say was I appreciate the program just because of the logical responses to racism, and specifically when you were talking about attending the workshop. I think it takes a lot of discipline to actually correct people when they think they're not being racist, to say, no, I don't think we should be coming with a attitude of just trusting people simply because they show up. And a lot of the responses you'll get from well-meaning, so-called well-meaning white people is usually a racist response, which reveals a lot about the individuals that are sitting there who believe themselves not to be racist. But I have to say that even listening to the clips at the beginning, I have usually a visceral response of embarrassment, and maybe some of the other callers can help me with that, because I just feel embarrassed that we're still responding to racism in the same manner, particularly with the situation, I believe it's in Washington, with the young man who was beaten for spending the night with a white woman. Towards the end of the clip, they were singing Amazing Grace, and the mother or someone said, you know, I forgive them. And I had not heard that part. I had heard parts of the interview where the mother was speaking, but I hadn't heard her specifically say immediately, I forgive them. And I've listened to a couple of the programs, and I've heard you all talk about that response where Black people are always immediately forgiving white people for acts of terrorism. So that's very disturbing. And I'm not sure how we can even come out of that, because we've learned to be so tolerant of some of the most gross violations of our humanity. And a lot of people have commented on Black Panther, and that'll probably be the last thing I comment on, just because I had no feelings about the movie. It looked really cool in the initial trailer that I'd seen. But then there's all of this hoopla that goes well beyond just the film. And I've said this to friends of mine, that I really started to get suspicious when they were almost making it into a revolutionary act. I think that is such a complete stretching. And after kind of looking at racism in depth a little bit more, I'm like, well, I think we latch on to it because we're also looking for acceptable ways to counter racism without, you know, doing some of the things you mentioned, which is changing our focus and actually having to force people. So we're willing to do the most passive things, I think, which is why I think Black people are falling into
this kind of obsession with seeing this movie as more than what it is, than just a fantasy, just entertainment. So if anyone has anything to elaborate on some of that, I'd be really appreciative. Thanks so much. I'll mute my line.
Awesome. Two first-time callers. So glad you were able to dial in. Don't be nervous. I think the previous first-time caller said he was nervous. Don't be nervous. We are all still learning and trying to solve this problem. But thank you, ma'am, for dialing in. Great observations on Black Panther. Appreciated everybody's commentary. I think Emmy as well, when she was saying the significance of the use of the term fantasy and make-believe when talking about this film, and remembering the words of Dr. Welsing, who always talked about the importance of us facing reality even when we are resistant to doing so. Extremely important. And in fact, that commentary, it reminded me there is footage where the white people who were involved in the making of Coming to America, I think they came out some years ago with like Eddie Murphy and Arsenio Hall, other folks are in it. But in that movie, or not, no, Coming to America, sorry, Coming to America. Oh, I did get it right. Eddie Murphy, Arsenio Hall, yes. They were talking about Coming to America, and they were where Eddie Murphy plays an African prince from Zamunda. And they were, the white people, they were talking, they said that they were trying to think of this mythical, almost the way that they were talking about Black Panther, they were trying to think of this mythical place in Africa where Black people ruled and all this. Well, like, they were serious. Like, it wasn't funny at all. But I mean, that's what they were saying. Like, yeah, we're going to have to make up this place. We'll just make up some place on the continent and put them there. And that's what we'll say, that Eddie Murphy is going to be the prince and he's coming to America to get his bride. But it reminded me of the way that whites were talking about Coming to America, the way that they were talking about Black Panther. I could be in error. I also am not. And as I said at the very beginning, this movie reminds me a lot of the way that I felt this time last year when Get Out was coming out. The black male caller who spoke up simultaneously, thank you for your patience, sir. Did you have commentary?
Yes, yes. Greetings. Gus, I'm glad to hear you are back. And greetings to hear all of the callers. I downloaded the podcast for the first time last week and listened to it as opposed to the other online means of listening. And I just found out about your situation. So I'm very glad to hear you are back on the broadcast and as well as the listeners. To the previous caller, I think the black female, I listened to this program, and this is probably some of the most black self-respect I see on a weekly, or hear rather, on a weekly basis. So this program is important to me because I get to hear a lot of beautiful black people. Regarding the experience with the yoga that you said you the terrorism you experienced with the white women and some of the other callers, it might be known my spouse is a yoga instructor. She owns a yoga studio here in Kansas City, and she almost daily comes home with trifling antics of some of her white clients, who many times treat her as if she works there and wants to speak to the owner, but then they find out that she is the owner of the studio. The antics are, like I said, almost daily, and so it's a global phenomenon. I also wanted to just inject briefly that I believe, and I might be mistaken, I wasn't alive then, but I believe that yoga has its origins in the area of the world known as Egypt, or then known as Kemet. And I believe Kemetic yoga, they have relief inscriptions that our ancestors put on the walls thousands of years ago that said that we were first channeling this energy that certain way. But I don't know if white people generally don't like to hear that or even know it. Regarding the movie and the clip that you played, I'm excited to hear non-white people speaking in a constructive manner about that film. I am very leery. I feel that there could be a lot of acts of violence that are perpetrated. I mean, I think with the situation of the white terrorists targeting immigrants in Italy, that non-white people should be very leery of going to movie theaters to view this movie, and not to be jovial or to be jocular, but I believe that there could be a large act of violence perpetrated upon non-white people because there's so many non-white people, specifically black people in this part of the world, and I hear globally that are interested in going to see that movie. White people have never ended their projects of terrorism, whether it's visual terrorism, mental terrorism. There could be so many things that could occur to non-white people. So I would caution against this film, and just because, as the previous caller stated, there's been a lot of hoopla. But there's a lot of other things in the system that are going to give us issues. I also thought, too, I've been listening to, earlier today, I was listening to Dr. Campbell on the Cows, the third interview, and he said something which I think that might give us some positive energy or some thoughts regarding the problem and solution, that he quoted someone, I believe, an anthropologist, Mead, it might be, but he quoted someone saying that just a few individuals would come up with the solution to the problem of white terrorism. And so sometimes our brothers and sisters, including ourselves, are very confused about the solution. And we try to come up with all kinds of ways, and we end up abusing ourselves even more. But it just takes a few. I believe that it will be a few non-white people, not masses and droves, and definitely not the greater number of people probably in this part of the world that could come up with a solution. And he also said something regarding that made me think about the Myrtle Beach situation regarding black people. We know how to go. We know where to go. We know how to go. We know how to get really fly bikes. We know how to get really fly clothing, but we're still being abused like we were getting abused 50 years ago, like we were being abused 100 years ago. And white people are fully dedicated, to me, it's just fully dedicated to practicing racism the way they like it, until we, as brought up earlier, force them to stop. So I do appreciate that. Oh, and to my final comment will be regarding the young black male who said he had a challenge with a non-white female who did not want to speak with him or did not want to just show any romantic interest or in speaking further with him. On a personal level, I have lost many individuals, including quote-unquote love interests, before finding my attempted spouse due to my views on racism. And that's when I was more confused, and now that I'm less confused, I have no white friends. White people stay away from me almost on a daily basis. They're almost repulsed by my presence, it feels like sometimes. And non-white people as well. Non-white people treat me sometimes equally, if not worse. I had an experience the other day. So your views on racism are going to cause people to stay away from you, sometimes even attempt to harm you. And if you want to practice counter-racism, you will have to understand that that the majority of the individuals on this planet, black and non-white, will likely be against you because we do live in a system of racism, white supremacy, or so I propose. So I'll take my call offline. I appreciate all of the callers and the host as well. Thank you.
Indeed. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary, if we have not heard from you, line should be open. Proceed.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, this is HV. Is the sound and everything okay?
Crystal.
Okay. Well, greetings to everybody on the line, and Gus, and, you know, welcome back. And Gus, I guess I'm going to be a little uncodified, and I am going to kind of harp, like, I'm extremely happy to, to have you back. And it was real hurtful, like, when we just didn't hear from you at all, like to the point of just, you know, tears and just worry and all that, because, you know, at least for me, as many hours as I've listened to this show, like, I couldn't help but get attached to you, and you're one of the people that I look up to so much, because you speak about racism, in my view, with so much boldness and a boldness and a courage and a courage that I don't have as of yet, and that I'm growing more and more and having. But I'm just, you know, really grateful that, you know, nothing happened to you, because when you speak like that, like, you know, obviously the terrorists, they don't like it. And so just really scared that one of them had, you know, got to you or something like that. And I just really thank God that it didn't. But I had a question that I wanted some advice on. I had an experience just last night, I believe it was, with an Asian female, and she was at a pharmacy, and I was getting medicine, and she was very nasty to me, and you could tell that she really had a problem with me because of my color. And I noticed that, you know, I get that, you know, from Asians and, you know, just everybody that is, I guess, not black. And she would, you know, close the door when she knew that I was coming next. She would close the window. And even when I came up to get my medicine, she was supposed to fill it. And then she said she was going to wait for when she was done. And what I came to discover is that she was never going to wave to me. She was actually going to leave me out there in the cold, just waiting and waiting and waiting, I guess, until I either left or, you know, I guess had the common sense to just go back up there and ask if everything was ready and everything. And she just was so, and then when she was explaining to me about why she didn't, first she asked me, was I waiting a long time? And it's like, well, you the one told me to wait, so you know this. And she was just really trying to rub it in, and I told her yes or whatever. She was like, oh, I just feel real bad, and she just gave me all these conflicting excuses as to why she never waved back to call me back up there to get my medicine that she had filled. The way she treated me is fortunate that she even filled it, but this I guess is my question. On the one hand, I know that it's not in my interest to be upset with non-white people, like, for any reason. And that I need to try to, you know, be patient with them so that I can work with them to solve this problem. On the other hand, it's very, very frustrating, very sometimes even hurtful, especially last night. It was especially hurtful because you didn't have to do that. You didn't have to be like so cruel to me. I never did anything to you. You didn't have to try to leave me out there in the cold. It's just not that serious. You have resources that we don't get. Y'all got almost as much money as white people. And I'm talking about Asians specifically in terms of your net worth and all of that. So I guess my question is, how is it that I can, I guess, think about other non-white people? Because honestly, if she were black, I would be more patient. But when it comes to other non-white people, I just really, really struggle. And sometimes I want to fight them, or I want to get them fired, or just something. And so how should I think about, I guess, other non-white people that truly this way for no reason? So that's my question. I hope I didn't take over the 5 minutes. And I'll mute my line.
Yes, ma'am. No problem. My thoughts, other people can share their views the same way people have responded to the male caller who was asking about the, I guess you call it, quote-unquote, dating situation. My view would be the production of justice should be about eliminating any and all mistreatment. With the situation that you talked about, where you were going to the pharmacy and this Asian female was being discourteous to you and lied to you about, you know, wait here and then she'll come back, and you had to go, you know, track her down to get your medication, I would report her. I know Dr. Cambon, he was referenced. He has said, and I think he has said on the broadcast before, I think repeatedly, in fact, in those type of situations, he advocates contacting the owner of the establishment. If you can contact direct manager, that's fine. But I know he's also said just contacting the owner directly, doing a handwritten letter. That's something that he's advocated, and explaining exactly what transpired, her being discourteous to you and everything that you felt was less than stellar customer service that you got while trying to get your medication. Then you had to ultimately track her down to get the prescription filled, to write that out. And, you know, is this, you know, how customers are supposed to be treated when they come to the pharmacy, and allow them to proceed from there in dealing with it? But I don't think you should accept, I don't think you or any other black person should accept mistreatment from another non-white person, even if it was a black person. And I can totally understand the logic of you saying, you know, I would be more patient if it was a black person. But I think a number of folks on this broadcast have expressed, you know, hey, mistreatment is mistreatment. And I am not in the business of accepting mistreatment from anybody, because that's a massive problem, too, where a lot of black people, anti-blackness, that's one of the major products of this system, where a lot of black people in those positions will mistreat and not give the same quality of service to a white patron who's coming to the pharmacy. So I advocate we should be against any form of mistreatment. Black people are mistreated all the time. We should be trying to stop that every opportunity that we can. I think you should report. Now, you can still do that. You can write that up. You can say, hey, I had to come and get medication. I was already not at my best. And it took me some time to process, but this was a really incorrect, or I received massively incorrect treatment on whatever the date it was, time, and, you know, go write down. Her name should be on the packaging from the prescription, so you can write it out, name, date, all of that good stuff. I would write it up, contact the folks, and report it, and, you know, see if you can get something done. That's my view on that. Other folks can share their thoughts as well.
May I ask one quick problem?
Yes, ma'am.
Do I have, as a black person, do I have any leverage against, like, an Asian, especially not a white person, but, you know, an Asian, them seemingly being next in line to white people, of being mistreated by her? Does that make sense, what I'm asking?
I don't really understand. Maybe, go ahead.
I guess what I mean is, like, do I really have any, realistic hope of, as a black person, saying, you know, this Asian person mistreated me. Like if I go and say a white person mistreated me, they're not going to, most of the time, they're not going to do nothing about it. So do I have, you know, much more hope, you know, with an Asian person, being that nobody really cares about how anybody treats black people?
Well, that is true. We are in a system of white supremacy. So, you know, we are devalued constantly. That's what the system is supposed to be about, stomping on black people all day long, eternally. That said, I would not make it about saying that this person mistreated me because I'm black. Now, unless she was calling you a nigger or something like that, unless it was that explicit, if she was just discourteous and lied to you and left you out in the cold and that sort of thing, I wouldn't make it that she was racist or that she did this because I'm black or anything about her being Asian. It would just be, this is incorrect customer service, that I came to get a prescription filled and these things happened. And this to me is anomalous. I have not been treated this way before when I come to get a prescription filled. And further, I shouldn't be treated this way. This is not the way customers, this is not what a customer should have to go through to get their medication, unless I've been misinformed or however, you know, you want to write it up. But I would address it that way. It wouldn't be about, I think this was racist. It was just, this was incorrect for whatever reason it was. And what is the procedure for remedying this? That's the way that I would approach it.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And again, other folks, if they, you know, have thoughts, they can feel free to share as well. Anybody that we missed completely? Anybody who has a hand up that we've not heard from at all?
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. Good evening, everyone. I agree with what you said to the person who just called about their health issue, and I would stress it as a health issue. And what I might do in addition is, people do read those public Yelp reviews or whatever, and I would go back and ask for that person's name. And especially if they have a name that's close to their culture, I will put that in the Yelp review. I went to visit whatever her name is at the establishment, and this person treated me improperly, and I don't understand why. And, you know, because that, people do read those, and at a minimum, you do have that public recourse about that. About the young man, I think a lot of people gave a good suggestion about asking questions. So I had to found a website with questions, because, you know, you can say ask questions, but what questions do you ask if you've never asked questions before? Now, I don't know necessarily. They have some good questions, and they're kind of separated between boyfriend and girlfriend. What I would do is look at all of them. There are like 200 of them. I won't ask them all at once. That would definitely scare anybody away, even if they do agree with what you believe in. I might take a few at a time, ask them on each day, or have some kind of group event, or, you know, watch, I don't know, people watch things on TV or whatever. a book reading. That would probably be more important. Discuss a book reading, and during that book reading, bring up some of these questions, put them in a bowl like a game or something like that. But the website here is pairedlife1word.com, and I can just send the link to Gus. I guess that's probably best. He could put it on the website or wherever he puts it. I mean, you, Gus, wherever you put it. Because, like I said, and the questions for, like I said, they're for a boyfriend, but I think they will be good to ask a potential girlfriend. If someone's out for a girlfriend, they will be good to ask a potential boyfriend. And they do put them in categories. Some, I think, are more important than others. But the first question they actually have is, if you could fix one world problem, what would it be? And I think we all know racism is a world problem. So you can kind of get some things out. Thank you.
Oh, appreciate that. If you send me the site, I'll post it on the Facebook page. Share with other folks if they want to check out some of the questions to ask. I think Mr. Fuller, he talks about those 200 questions, and I've heard some of the questions he recommends asking as well. I think Mr. Edward Williams on counter-racism.com, he asked to email me just the other day, checking on me about the flood as well. But he also has questions on his website, and people submitted a lot as well. You can go there and check out some of the questions, but that's always a good way to go as well. Anybody else that we missed? Greetings, Princess. Good to hear from you. Even with the whole flood situation, I was able to nab a few bars of my African heritage soap. It's been super helpful in this whole nasty situation. In fact, I went to two yoga classes, and even after sweating profusely in two yoga classes, I still smelled like African heritage soap.
Wow. Well, that's good to hear. Good evening, everyone, and good evening, Gus. I'm very happy that you're back on air, because you did have me worried, as well as others. And I just wanted to share some workplace stuff. Is that okay? I mean, I know you've been gone for a month, so.
Always appreciate hearing workplace racism.
Okay, because I know you're going to enjoy this. So let me set this up this way. As of today, I had just learned my other manager, I'm a member of management where I currently work at in Ocala, Florida. And so my other manager was coming in to relieve me for the day because I had open. And basically, he was sharing with me some developments within the company that had just made national news. And basically, what he was telling me was that the store manager and the assistant store manager were both out of town in Tampa at some type of convention, because our company has just went through with the acquisition of Rite Aid. So it's a lot of stuff going on, yada, yada. Well, apparently Tuesday, a customer had called and spoke with him, stating that she wanted to speak to a manager. She wasn't satisfied with whoever had answered the call and got the initial response, so she came in person to speak to a manager. And it just so happened to be my colleague. And basically, she had stated that, you know, she's been coming to this location for a number of years since they opened up in 2008. And that she had just gotten word that our company is going to be adopting the transgender restrooms in effect. And this broke Tuesday. They kept it from us, and so we just found out today after people came back from the convention, because apparently it came up in the meeting, because apparently there's a lawsuit where this heesh out in California basically came into one of our store locations and wanted to use the restroom. And the associate went to take them to the restroom, to let them in or whatnot. And the person demanded to go into the female's restroom. And the sales associate refused. Manager was called, and the manager upheld what the sales associate was saying. So after speaking with corporate and all this stuff, I don't know what transpired as far as the deal was done, but this is going to be in effect immediately in all store locations, and it had a lot of people up in arms. Even people on the floor today was pretty much just venting, like, you know, that's the line in the sand for them, because they're just not tolerating it, because it's just too much stuff going on. So with that being said, 2 weeks ago, coming up this Monday, I had an incident with an employee that I've had an ongoing issue with for quite some time. This employee is of Puerto Rican descent. I classify her as white because she is very white identified, a Trump supporter, but she has apparently some, quote, black people in her family. But nonetheless, if you see her, I would still classify her as white. She's originally from New York. And so I guess she has this Bronx, Black Harlem, I don't know, Puerto Rican mentality, I don't know. But my stance, and I've been adamant about it for years, is that people of Latin descent or Hispanics, I treat and engage them as if they are white, unless they prove elsewise. So as I was coming into work that day, 2 weeks ago, this individual came at me about a situation with a customer who had made a purchase of $600 worth of gift cards. And our policy apparently is, which is she should know, we can only do 500 minimum. So per day. And so she has this thing of trying to come at me in order to antagonize me, to ask me random stupid questions that she should already know about. And so today she wanted to pick the day to try and talk to me about this. So she did. I just told her, basically walked her through answering her own question. And as she was doing this, she was describing this customer who had came in as a nigger. So I'm looking at her because, like I said, I'm very codified at work. I don't, even with other black individuals that's been there, I don't use the term nigger, or, you know, I don't talk about race or politics per se. And if I do, it's very loose and general and whatnot. So she went on to describe this customer, saying that he was being a nigger and this, that, and the other. Now, she wanted to, I'll finish the part. So as I looked at her, I was like, well, I'm not sure why you were saying that to me like that. It was just out of place. And so when I asked her for a description of the customer so that way I could review the video, so I would be able to let the other sales associate know up front, she was kind of hesitant in giving me an overall description of this person. So I just finally came out and said, well, look, is this person black or white? And she was like, oh, no, it's a white guy. It's an old white guy. And I looked at her. I said, he's a white guy? And she was like, yeah. I said, but you referred to him as a
racial slur. And I said it just like that. Like, I wanted to let her know that, you know. And she was like, well, you know what I mean. I'm from New York. And, you know, nigga is like, someone that's dirty or nasty or this, that, and so I was like, oh. And I was like, I don't even refer to myself that way, so I'm not sure as to why you felt the need to use that term in describing this customer, according to her definition. So I was like, okay. I said, well, I'll tell you what. Store manager is in pharmacy. I think you need to speak with him about this issue, because I'm kind of like counting money, and I just got here with a few minutes, and you're already hitting me with this. So she went on ahead and spoke to the store manager. 45 minutes later, I'm leaving the front doing something, and I get called to the front again, and I'm told that there's a gentleman up front that needs to speak with me. So I go up front. It's a white old male, looks like a veteran in some surfer gear, I don't know. He doesn't look like a nigger, and he definitely doesn't look dirty. So when I realize who it is, I immediately escort him back to pharmacy because I wanted to let my store manager see who this person was and explain to him what had just happened 45 minutes earlier. And so as I'm trying to explain it to him, at first he was all defensive, saying, oh, no, you're talking about the wrong customer. And I was like, Mark, I need you to listen to me for a minute. And so as I explained it to him bit by bit, he looked at me and he was like, well, what did she say? And I said, well, she used the N-word. She said that, and he was like, well, that doesn't make any sense. That doesn't even apply. And he was like, why would she do that? I said, because that was an indirect way at her to take a dig at me. And so he was just like, well, we're not supposed to use that word around here at all. And I said, exactly. I said, but he doesn't look like he's dirty. According to her definition, she went into this whole spiel about, whatnot. So for the past 2 weeks, it's been a whole bunch of charading around. Because I'm trying to finalize my time there at this point. I am looking for work, but I'm just trying to just keep my cool, which is very hard because shortly after that, I had spoken to the pharmacy manager because I guess it, letting her know what was going on. Because I call myself speaking with her at times when I need to vent about things going on in the store. And so that day, she seemed like she was on board with what I was saying, talking about how wrong it was. But then the following day, she called me to pharmacy and asked me how I was doing and all this stuff. And then out of nowhere, I guess she felt compelled to say, well, Princess, I just wanted to talk to you because I know you was upset, and I just want you to hear me out because I know it's, quote, two sides to a story, but I don't want you to think I'm defending her. But she wasn't trying to say nothing in a racist manner because the word nigger is in the dictionary, and she used it correctly. Now, she's saying this. This is the pharmacist. She's saying this in front of all other employees. And like, it was like the room stopped because everybody was like, what is going on? And this is a white female, by the way. And I said, what? And she was like, well, I mean, it's in the dictionary. She used the term properly. And I was just like, oh, okay. I said, I've never seen it in the dictionary. I've never heard of, and she was just like, you've never heard of white niggers and black niggers? So my friend, he was just like, and at that point, I was just like, no, I've never heard of that before.
You can take about 30 seconds. 30 seconds.
Okay. Well, like I said, to be continued, but I just wanted to share that because, yeah. Okay.
Appreciate it, Princess. We should be here this Thursday for Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. I had people from outside the United States who emailed while we were off the air about workplace racism. I had people, once they found out about the flood situation, were concerned, like, oh man, that's really sad and, you know, rough to hear your housing situation. So when is workplace racism going to be back on? Because the white people have been acting up on the job and that sort of thing. So we should be back Thursday for workplace racism. We'll be looking forward to that if folks have suggestions. My quick thought for your, or I guess series of anecdotes with the situation where this female, you said you suspected racist, she's quote unquote Puerto Rican and all that, suspected racist, where she said nigger, where she was talking about this white guy. I generally encourage not saying that a white person practiced racism, or I wouldn't even suggest saying that, well, the person said it in order to get at you or to insult you or whatever the case, because that's the sort of thing that you can't prove. I'm a big advocate of not making any sort of charges on the job against a white person or really anybody that you cannot substantiate. And really, even if you can, I still would be, you know, very hesitant about making accusations because I've seen where whites can really go on the attack and then, you know, come back and charge you for making some sort of accusation against them. I would just, it was said, and, you know, then folks can investigate as to what should be done about that and why she did it and all that. You know, we can investigate and get those answers as we proceed. Other folks, did we miss anybody? Did anybody have a hand up that we missed completely? We want to get in before we wrap things up. Did we, Imhandisi? You had a hand up. Did you have commentary, sir? You should be with us as well.
Yes, sir. Greetings to you, the host, the callers, and the listeners. I wanted to speak to the African heads of state again. I have not heard anything from the African heads of state in regards to what is going on with these people that have called themselves white people. These ice albinos, the creature, ice albinos, the albino that has been mixed with a monkey, they're all related. They're all inbred. They all do the same thing. I haven't heard anything from the African heads of state about what is going on with this problem of white people. And here in America, the indigenous, we are being killed as everywhere else, but here we're very close to these people. And one way they're killing us is there are clouds out that completely cover the sky and there's no sun. You can't see the sun. There'll be some light during the day, but you can't see the sun. And this is months and months at a time. We need help. We have to solve this problem. Thank you.
Appreciate that, sir. The caller at 5631. 5631. Did you have commentary you wanted to share before we wrap things up? 5631. You just listening, or did you have a final word you wanted to get in? 5631.
Oh yeah, Gus. I just wanted to say thank you to all the callers for giving me advice about what I had going on with that black female. What I didn't mention was that we were together for like 4 months, and what got us together was my interest in racism and me reading the code book, and then that's how we connected. But, you know, over the months, I guess my focus on solving the race problem, what I made my goal, it waned on her. And I guess, you know, maybe I wasn't a good partner or whatever. You know, it's just something to learn from. But again, thanks to all the callers for their advice. And Gus, I'm glad that you're back. And I'll try to call in and be more concise with what I have to say, because I was really nervous today when calling in because it was my first time. But again, thanks. Appreciate it.
Thank you for dialing in, sir. Don't be nervous again. We are still learning. Victims of white supremacy, just stumbling, fumbling as best we can, trying to solve this problem. We should be here on Wednesday. We should have Dr. Frances Cress-Welsing's sister, Lauren Cress-Love. She should be back with us. What seems like eons ago in December, NASA, they had a ceremony to recognize Robert Lawrence. That is Dr. Welsing and Miss Lauren Cress-Love, their late brother-in-law. He was in the NASA space program in the 1960s. He was killed. We talked about it. Lauren Cress-Love talked about it on both of her visits, actually, to the Cal. She gave her views. She speculates that he was killed training this German pilot who had already flunked this program and who seemed like he shouldn't, you know, have even been qualified to have been there, but was killed. Robert Lawrence was killed, and they had just honored him for his contributions to the space program in December. And some of our listeners, I think Roz and some of the other callers, brought that up. We're saying, hey, maybe we should get her on the program to talk about this. I called her earlier this week and talked to her about it. Of course, she knew about the ceremony. I think she said that his sister, Robert Lawrence's sister, was at the ceremony. I think she spoke a little bit, and she talked about some of her memories and what have you. But she should be with us this coming Wednesday, February 14th. Lauren Cress-Love, looking forward to having her back on the broadcast. Did anybody have a final quick word they needed to get in before we wrap up? If you can get it in 30 seconds. Anybody have anything they need to get in that will take 30 seconds or less?
Yes,
Mabier. Yes. I didn't see the name, but the person who dialed in with the free HD line. Yes, go ahead, ma'am.
I just want to quickly say, Gus, I've been praying for you, and I hope that you get to go home soon. And I've been promoting your PayPal link, and I plan to donate soon, and I hope others do too. And that was it.
Much obliged. Thank you kindly for sharing. And I too hope we get to go home soon. Red in Nevada, that was quick. Did you have something you can get in 30 seconds or less?
Yes, just quickly to that young male, I just wanted to say, because I actually had to deal with, actually, it was funny, there's a black male who was dealing with the same thing that I had to come in contact with, but basically, you know, just, I guess what I'm trying to say is maybe it is actually going to just work out for the best, and, you know, I'm glad that he is able to call in, and thank you, I'll mute my line.
Hang on. With that, we should be here, I think, Wednesday. If something happens, I'll update at Black Talk Radio Network and the Facebook page, all the regular outlets. I've been catching up on my email, but catching up on a month and a half of emails has taken some time. I think I'm moved about halfway through the pile. I've been going through my Facebook messages as well, so bear with me as I get things caught up, as we try and get back on schedule, try to get some semblance of balance back with the broadcast and what have you. But thanks, everyone, for the patience, well wishes. Hope the program continues to be worthy of your time and energy. If you have questions, suggestions, gripes, feel free to drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com. Untiljustice@gmail.com. I will definitely emphasize sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. I remember while we were on hiatus riding through Seattle and seeing sobriety checkpoint signs up in the city, and they don't even have a lot of black people here, so I can't even imagine what it would be like in areas with a higher population of black residents. But I definitely think it would behoove us to eliminate that from our diet consumption patterns, alcohol, any of the other poisons that whites come up with. That I think would help in our counter-racist effort from many different aspects, economics, just all the way around. You do not want to be in any environments where whites are consuming alcohol, extraordinarily dangerous. Certainly, if you're operating a vehicle, even if it's a Dodge Ram, you do not want to be intoxicated, whether you're the driver, passenger, even if you're a pedestrian, you do not want to be under the influence and make it easy for the Daniel Holtzclaws of the world to terrorize, rape, and pillage you while we are on the plantation of white supremacy. If war is being waged against us, that is one I wanted to get in as a correction. We are not at war, victims of racism. Racist man, racist woman, racist child, they are at war with us. That is a substantial difference. And if that is true, that should be reflected in our behavior. And I guarantee you, you are not going to be an alert counter-racist soldier if you are under the influence while you are out and about. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.